Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our council meeting, and this is Tuesday, May the 27th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello is absent. Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Here. I should indicate to you that Councilmember Costello is sort of recovering from surgery. He is mobile, and he's indicated an interest to be here tonight for at least one of our public hearings, but he's going to time it so that he doesn't have to spend too long in the chair. I'm sure you can understand. So we should see him in about 30 to 45 minutes. Item 3 is our flag salute, and we're very pleased to have Lenny Jones here from the Rotary Club of Arroyo Grande. Lenny is going to lead our flag salute. If you would please remain standing for invocation. Pastor Jerry Nelson is here from the Arroyo Grande Seventh-day Adventist Church to do that for us.
Please stand. Hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Let's bow our heads. Our great and mighty Heavenly Father, we thank you so much for the privilege of gathering on this absolutely beautiful evening to do your work. We ask that you would guide and direct the council members and those that are involved in the decisions that are made at this meeting, that they would have a sense of your guidance and direction. Lord, we want your will to be done. We thank you so much for this beautiful place that we live in, this wonderful community, and the privilege that we have of serving to make it the best that it can be. We pray these things in your holy name. Amen.
Amen.
Jerry, thank you very much for doing our invocation, and we hope you'll come back and do it for us again. Okay. Lenny, where are you?
There.
Okay. We get to hear about Rotary.
Yeah, so I'd like to say I am from the number one Rotary Club in the Five Cities area, which is the Arroyo Grande Rotary. However, we do have numerous other Rotary Clubs, which is Five Cities Pismo Beach, which Steve Adams belongs to, and he's back from Uganda doing good Rotary work. Thank you very much. We also have the Grover Beach Rotary Club. We have the Eco Club and also the Napomo Club. And the Arroyo Grande Club, we're the one that does the famous fish fry for the Harvest Festival. We just gave $10,000 to the high school student last week at the Scholarship Awards. And I'd like to say happy birthday to Kristen. Happy birthday. And congratulations on your fourth place in the Strawberry Stampede.
Thank you.
You know, that's about the reddest I've ever seen you.
Okay, moving on.
All right. I'm one of those respectful mayors that will not ask which birthday this is.
Okay.
And then there's Lenny. Okay, moving on to item 5. This is our agenda review. 5A is closed session announcements. The council did meet in closed session on May 13th, and we took no reportable action. Is that correct?
No, we didn't take. We did take reportable action. We approved a settlement agreement with the AGPOA regarding a Public Employment Relations Board complaint that had been filed.
Thank you for clarifying that. Appreciate it. That's why we have a city attorney. 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries. Tim, let me check in with you on an issue here. Later on in council communication, I'm going to be bringing up the need for a representative to fill in on the COG meeting on June the 4th. I will not be available, and neither will Joe, as my designated alternate. I can designate a temporary alternate, but that person would not be a voting member unless we're able to make a motion to approve that action during a council meeting. It is not on this evening's agenda. Is there a mechanism, perhaps an emergency item that we can put on the agenda and take care of that piece of business?
And the need to take action on that item came to your attention subsequent to the posting of the agenda?
Yes.
Then we probably can satisfy.
Item six is special presentations. We do have one this evening, and this is a presentation by the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments on the U.S. 101 corridor story. I'm sorry, study. Good evening.
Thank you, Mayor Ferrara. Members of the council, I am Jessica Berry, and I'm with the San Luis Obispo Council of Governments. I'm certain all of you know what that is, but just in general, I'll let you know that we are a regional transportation planning and funding agency, and our board is made up of all of the county supervisors plus a representative from each of the incorporated cities, and Mayor Ferrara is on our board. Right now, I'm going to present to you about the U.S. 101 Corridor Mobility Master Plan, and I have come to this council and presented on this item before, so this is a follow-up to let you know where we are in the study and what the next steps are. And it will just not take me very long to get through it. And I think Teresa's going to help me with the slides. All right, so moving on. Here we are. This is a little hard to read up there. I apologize for that. But basically, this is to let you know what we've done so far.
Excuse me just a second. Can we maybe try dimming one of the banks of lights? See if we can't get that to pop out. Is that a little bit better? Can you all see it in the audience? Chuck, can you reach that light switch behind you? Thank you.
A little better.
Better?
I'll let you know what it says, too. So in the boxes that are hard to read there are the ones on the left. And basically, these are the tasks that we set upon to do when we started this project in the spring of last year. We developed a project vision, and we chose performance measures to use to evaluate the corridor. And then we used those performance measures. We looked at the existing conditions on the corridor and the future conditions, which are based on 2035. That's our future year. And that comes from the regional transportation plan that SLOCOG did in 2010. So we based our future on what we thought was going to be the future in 2010. And that was the target year was 2035. We developed what we call the cartogram, and I'll show that to you on the next slide. And that was our way of measuring how the corridor was functioning. We took 12 performance measures that you'll see on the next slide, and we put them on a 0 to 10 scale, and we laid them across the 70 miles, 10 being the worst and 0 being the best. So anywhere you see peaks are the places where there are greater problems on the corridor. So you'll see that on the next slide. Moving into the deficiencies and the performance improvements, we actually took the cartogram to our board in October of 2013. I should say also that back in June of last year, we did our first round of public outreach. We had three workshops. We did an online interactive mapping tool where people could put their comments about the corridor. We also went to farmers markets and the Mid-State Fair and several park and ride lots and did intercept interviews with people to figure out where the problem areas were. I also did go around to councils and county advisory committees. We had a polling tool, so I would do a presentation and ask people questions and they could vote. So that was part of how we developed the information. So we took to our board in October the cartogram and the areas, the problem areas that we saw needed to be evaluated as part of the phase two analysis, and they approved that in October, and then we started our phase two outreach in January. We had another online tool. We did another three workshops. And now we're in the extended technical analysis, which is that fourth box down. Our consultants are developing costs of projects on the corridor that we're looking at for improvements. There's quite a few, and I'll show you the slide shortly. But they're doing a cost analysis on all of those, and then we're weighing the benefits. So we'll have a cost-benefit ratio. So you're the first council I'm going to with this updated information. You'll see on the slide there that it says we're doing our Phase 3 public outreach on May 31st, but we're not. We decided to postpone that until July, and that was a decision we made last week with our task force members. And we made that decision because we wanted to be sure that what we brought to the public for the final phase of outreach is really valuable, really easy to read and look at and know what's going on. And I should point out that our task force is made up of members of Caltrans and SLOCOG and the RTA and the cities that are affected by the corridor. So Teresa is on our task force also. So our draft plan will be going to the SLOCOG board in August, and our final actually will probably take in October. But I would like to point out at the same time as this project, we're actually working on our regional transportation plan update. So this plan is just for 101, and it's just for the 101 corridor, essentially. But for the regional transportation plan, which we update every 4 years, that will cover the entire county, and it will cover all modes of transportation. And the information from this study will inform what's in there. There were a lot of issues recognized. So those blocks of orange are the areas on the corridor that we're going to focus on as part of the technical analysis. That cost benefit that we're doing, that'll be on these segments. So how that applies to you is that first focus study segment starts at Traffic Way and extends north to Avila Beach Drive. So that area of 101 is included in this study for more intense technical analysis. I would also like to point out that black line that you can see kind of running up and down along the corridor, what it's showing you is the public input we got. So that line represents each comment that we received on the corridor. And you can see that in many places, it's very similar to what's actually happening on the corridor. So that was very reassuring that the technical analysis and the public's experience of the corridor are very similar. So that was reassuring to us. There are areas you can see where the public provided more comment beyond what we were seeing in the technical analysis, but both of those areas are included in the study also. So we are looking at those. Oh, and that is the worst slide to look at. Sorry about that. This is just a more close-up view of the area that we'll be focusing on for this that's relevant to Arroyo Grande. And it starts, as I said, at Traffic Way, and it goes north to Avila Beach Drive. And we're looking at multiple types of improvements through there. So some of the improvements, so I say there's 7 project types and locations with 43 variations. So we're looking at one of the projects or issues might be just congestion on the corridor. There's different ways to improve that. Would an HOV lane be good, or would another general purpose lane? Would better access to transit be more? There's several different ways to kind of try to fix the problem. And that's what those variations are. The 43 variations are variations in the project. And those are all being costed out, and then they'll be evaluated. So as I said, we decided to move our final workshop. It was going to be on May 31st, but we've moved it to July. However, we are taking an item to the SLOCOG board on June 4th that looks at the benefit cost analysis and the way that we'll be sort of looking at and prioritizing the projects to put them into our regional transportation plan. And our consultant team will be in town to do that, to present to our board. And then we'll bring it to the board again in August as the draft plan. I will keep you informed of when that next workshop is. Originally, I had come here with the idea that I would be telling you, don't forget to come to our workshop on May 31st, but we will be moving it to July. So we'll be sure to get you informed about when that's going to happen as it gets closer. And that is all I have, and I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Jessica. Questions? And can we have the lights again? Thank you. Questions?
I have a comment.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to say that one slide with the bar graphs is really difficult to, you know, in a glance to, mm-hmm. You might want to redo that in some simplified way so that the public can see it and understand it, because some people are visual, and that's a hard slide to wrap your head around. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's just my thought.
Okay, anything else? All right. Jessica, thanks so much for taking time and joining us, and good presentation. Okay, see you next meeting.
All right.
Okay, moving on to item 7. Item 7 is community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for members of the public to come forward and comment on items that are not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking any action on matters not posted on the agenda. We would ask that you keep your comments brief, 3 minutes or less. Please address the council as one body. Once again, items not on the agenda tonight. If there's anyone who would like to come forward with observation or suggestion, anything related to that, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? Wow. Okay. Seeing no one, we will close community comments and suggestions, and we will go to item 8, which is the consent agenda. And on the consent agenda, this is normally a group of items that the council approves in one motion, unless there is an item on the consent agenda that a member of the council would like to pull for an independent action, further clarification, or discussion. And once again, this is also an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward and comment on any of the items that are on consent. If you have a copy in front of you, we're going to be addressing consent items 8A through 8K. So any of those items are open for discussion from the public. If anyone would like to come forward, once again, please keep your comments brief. Anyone on 8I? And with that, I will entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8K, with the exception of 8E, 8F, and 8H, as in Henry.
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
And a second. Any discussion? Anything to read in there tonight, Tim?
No, Mayor Farr.
Okay, thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you sneak in?
Yeah.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello, or Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Apologize.
All right, so let's go back to 8E and Councilmember Barnett.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I just wanted to pull this today just for two reasons. I just wanted to say that I was glad that we had written the letter of support for the Land Conservancy regarding the Pismo Preserve project. And I know probably most people, if you're following that in the newspaper, the Land Conservancy is looking for a total of $12 million, and I think they've collected about $10 million to preserve 10 miles of trails sort of to the left of Pismo Heights in the county. And so I think it's really important that the public knows they're still looking to collect the money. It's once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The owner wants to close escrow by August 1st, I believe. And once, if we don't have the money, then it moves on and it very well might be developed with houses. So I would encourage everyone to go on the Land Conservancy website and check that out. So I'm glad that we are writing the letter. We did, since the council did write the letter of support, we did receive a letter from the Land Conservancy asking the City of Arroyo Grande to contribute towards the project. And $40,000, and apparently that's what the citizens in Arroyo Grande have contributed to this project, is $40,000. So they are asking the city to match that, and I will be bringing that up at the end of our agenda under council communications to ask the council if we will place that on a future agenda. Thank you.
Okay. And would you like to go on to item F?
Sure.
8F.
And then 8F, I have just a couple questions that I wanted to have the answers to before I voted on that. And is that Teresa or Jeff? Oh, Jeff. Hi, Jeff.
We're both available.
Okay, so the question I had, and I posed these questions to Steve, because there are some sensitive issues, and this is the consideration of a capital improvement project, Leanna Drive Creek Crossing, it's a waterline project. And the question is, there in the staff report, there was a lot of information on drilling and boring, and it seemed that some of the construction was going to be really close to homeowners, to houses. And I wanted to just find out if the work started at 7 a.m., did we think that was going to be a problem for the residents? Now, I know normally it's our code states that it's usually 7 a.m. I understand that, but this type of work seems to be different than just regular construction, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Certainly. I'll actually have Jeff and Chris from RENCON are both here. Chris assisted in the preparation of the initial study and mitigated negative declaration before you, and can speak more toward the CEQA, potential CEQA impact related to noise. I do not see anything that would preclude the city or should preclude the city from restricting it to 8 o'clock, and that wouldn't, it would just be a more restrictive mitigation measure, and it shouldn't affect the processing of our mitigated NEG deck.
So is that reasonable to suggest? I don't really know the nature of the work, but I was. So you think that's probably a good thing to do?
Yes, the decibels that were anticipated are not indicating a significant impact. However, they'll be heard in the neighborhood, and I think it would be appropriate to modify the time limit to 8 o'clock.
Okay. Thank you, Teresa. I appreciate that. And then also the construction work, a lot of it's going to be in the creek, and so my concern was, because it's a sensitive area, how often is a staff member going to be out at the project site, sort of looking over the construction company that's doing the work?
And I'll get Jeff to come up to the podium just to clarify. There will be a mitigated
inspection. We will have a contracted inspector on this project who will be there during the drilling portions at all times that the work is done. So we will have a representative working for the city, watching the contractor at all times during actual construction. On their preparation and their mobilization, we'll just come in and spot check a couple times a day. But during the construction work, fully staffed whenever the contractor's on site. Hopefully okay. That answers your question.
Okay, it does. Thank you very much, Jeff. I appreciate that. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions?
Yes.
Okay. How about a motion on 8E and F?
Do you want me to include? Okay. I move approval of 8E. I was going to do it separately because I'm changing the time on 8F.
Okay. All right. We have a motion to approve 8E and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay. 8F.
And I move approval of item 8F with the stipulation that work start at 8 a.m. instead of 7 a.m.
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion on this? Okay. Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right. Councilmember Brown, 8H.
Steve, I know we talked about this morning, but just to put it on the public record and kind of flesh it out for the public, because we did have a previous meeting, can you just kind of go over how we got to the particular point and what happened with the two bidders that dropped off?
I think I'll let Teresa do that since she's the project manager.
Certainly. We did place this project out for a rebid as directed by City Council and received bids on May 15th. We received low bids from Carroll Building Company and second position Vernon. Both companies requested withdrawal of their bid due to a misreading of the deductive alternative that was included in the specifications. And so the proposal this evening is to award it to the lowest responsive bidder at this time, which is GLR Construction.
Okay, so my next question is, and again, I'm trying to flesh this out for public record. The two that dropped off did not follow public bidding process correctly, at least in our view. Is that correct?
Um, That's correct.
Can you, I know attorneys like to keep it minimal, but can you tell me why?
They misapplied the bid specifications. Our deductive was used as an additive, and it ended up affecting their overall bid, and as a result, they withdrew their bids.
Okay, so with that, Mr. Mayor, all I'm going to say is, based on what's been fleshed out in public, I'm going to specifically request that we talk about whether there's any financial recovery for the mistakes that were made. I've been really upset since the start of this process when the consultant made a number of mistakes, and this further compounds that, and I'm looking for ways to save money for the taxpayers of Arroyo Grande, and so I'm specifically asking that we explore the idea and the possibility of going against bondholders who else might be responsible for those missed bids and go forward from there.
Okay. Was it the intent to do that anyway?
We'll be coming back to the council in, at the future meeting and get some official direction. They've been put on notice of the issue at this point, but there's a number of things that need to be considered, and so we'll be bringing that information to council.
So it's coming back?
It will be coming back, yes.
Now, with that, I'd move for approval.
All right. We have a motion to approve. Is there a second?
Second.
And a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. We're going to move on to item 9, public hearings. Item 9A is consideration of development code amendment case number 14-002 regarding vacation rentals and homestays.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. This is item 9A, consideration of development code amendment case number 14-002, establishing regulations for vacation rentals and homestays. We'll start with a little background about the project. Over the years, staff has received new of the existing bed and breakfast regulations, so Planning Commission directed us to tear that apart. For staff to determine an administrative permitting process instead of a conditional use permit. To limit the homestays to a maximum of 2 rooms in each dwelling, as well as not allow on-site advertising of homestays. Staff returned to the Planning Commission on March 18th, and the Planning Commission reviewed the revised ordinance and recommended the City Council adopt the ordinance. At that time, they did make one modification regarding the annual noticing requirement for vacation rentals. Originally, staff had crafted the ordinance in such a way that it required the operator to mail out essentially contact information for the vacation rental to all property owners within 300 feet. The Planning Commission felt that that would be better addressed at the staff level and let interested parties in the community to contact the Community Development Department. In researching the revised ordinance, staff looked at all of the administrative permits available and determined that the plot plan review was the most applicable existing administrative permit. The approval of the plot plan review certifies that the use will satisfy provisions of the development code. The code amendment in front of you also requires property owner notification of the decision regarding vacation rental applications. So this is the initial approval. In which case that would be noticed to all property owners within 300 feet. The purpose of that is to spread around the local contact information in case the owner or operator is out of the area. And it's not this is not required for homestays. Homestays would be reported to the Planning Commission, like all other minor use permits, on a list of administrative decisions. And currently, the processing fee for the plot plan review is $416. Staff anticipates that the permit processing will take some time in the beginning to kind of work out the kinks and become more familiar with the process, but we anticipate full cost recovery of staff time and resources following that initial period. The ordinance in front of you adds a few different code definitions and modifies one other, starting with the Bed and Breakfast Inn, which will now read, means an owner-occupied dwelling unit where 3 or more short-term lodging rooms and meals are provided for compensation or on-site signage is desired. The last part of that was added by the Planning Commission, where they saw the potential for a bed and breakfast that only has one or two rooms, who actually wants to be a bed and breakfast, wants to have on-site signage, not be considered a homestay and prohibited from on-site signage. So that part was added there. A homestay would mean an owner-occupied dwelling unit where a maximum of two short-term lodging rooms are provided for compensation. And a vacation rental would mean a structure being rented for less than 30 days without concurrently being occupied by the owner or operator, where short-term lodging is provided for compensation. The proposed ordinance also makes additions to both the residential and commercial use tables. Staff's initial attempt was to make these in line with the existing bed and breakfast regulations in the residential and commercial use tables. However, based on Planning Commission feedback, both uses are proposed to be allowed in the residential estate zoning district. That's the only difference between the existing bed and breakfast regulations and the proposed regulations in front of you. And with regard to the general plan on this topic, policies for vacation rentals and homestays are not identified in the general plan. However, staff believes that there are two economic development element policies that address tourism. The first policy is Economic Development Policy 6-3, which says to capitalize on development opportunities to increase lodging facilities, as well as ED 6-4, which is to expand the city's tourism potential through the internet and social media. Staff believes 6-4 applies since a large portion of the increased interest in these uses is because of the internet. There are land use element policies that do address the protection of residential neighborhoods, and so we wanted to highlight those as well. Land use element policy 12-10 states to ensure that residential accessory uses and buildings are consistent with the primary residential character of the area, as well as the overall small town character of Arroyo Grande. And implementing policy 12-10.1 says to prohibit accessory uses or hobbies that would create additional traffic or need for signage or parking, and ensure that the primary use of garage areas is for parking cars. At this time, staff does not think that these proposed regulations conflict with the land use policies due to the requirements being implemented in order to minimize impacts to the adjacent area, as well as the similarity of these uses being consistent with a homeowner having friends or family visit. Additionally, staff held two community meetings, the first on April 17th, the second on May 1st of this year. These are largely used in other jurisdictions out of the state. However, we do have an example locally. It's San Luis Obispo County, which allows vacation rentals in the communities of Cambria and Cayucas. Typically, these concentration limits would be intended to protect the character and the integrity of the residential neighborhood. This can be done. Staff identified four different ways this could potentially be done if the council chooses. One would be to limit the total number of permits issued citywide and have a maximum number, and once that number is met, no more are issued. Also, you could limit the numbers of permits that are issued annually and therefore do 10 per year and see how that goes. Third option would be to limit the number of permits based on a linear distance from existing operations. So if one use goes in at a location and the council directs on the distance from that, no more could be established within that radius. And the last option would be to limit the number of permits based on a linear distance from existing operations on the same street. This would mean that two operations could be have both rear yards backing up to each other as long as they're accessed from separate streets. With regard to environmental review, staff did determine that the project is categorically exempt pursuant to Section 15061B3 and 15308 of the CEQA guidelines. With regard to public notice and comment, a public hearing notice was published in the Tribune, posted at City Hall, and on the city's website on May 16th. Tonight's agenda was posted at City Hall on Thursday, May 22nd. And the agenda and staff report were posted on the city's website on Friday, May 23rd. Obviously, in addition to the community meeting, staff has received considerable public comment from individuals on both sides of this issue. Proponents of the regulations argued that they provide lodging options to travelers. They provide raised in tax revenues and commerce to the city. They provide supplemental income for property owners and property. They provide property investments that end up benefiting the neighborhood, as people typically would not like to stay in something that's unattractive. Opponents of these regulations argue that the commercial operations increase traffic, on-street parking demands, and noise in residential neighborhoods, as well as allowing strangers easier access to these residential neighborhoods. Staff did receive one comment regarding the ability for the plot plan review for a vacation rental or homestay to be transferred to a subsequent owner and potentially even being advertised as a permitted operation. Typically, land use entitlements do run with the land, and therefore it would still be transferable with the ordinance as written in front of you. However, it should be noted that the new owner would be required to obtain a business license to in order to continue the operation and operate within the confines of the regulations. Also, staff did utilize the new community voice feature of the city's website. This allows further discussion on proposed regulations. Staff did receive three comments from the public in regards to the proposed ordinance, the one that is in your staff report, and as well as two more that were received later on Friday, May 23rd, after the agenda was prepared. However, all three were in support of the proposed regulations in front of you. And with that, the Planning Commission does recommend that the City Council introduce the proposed ordinance regulating vacation rentals and homestays. I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, thank you. Questions for Matthew?
I do.
All right, Councilmember Brown.
Good presentation, as always. Thank you for that. I know this is not an easy issue to deal with, and I appreciate your tackling it. We've had a lot of pros and cons come forward in previous meetings. A lot of the people that are against it were worried about unsavory characters in the neighborhood or parking issues or noise issues. My first question is, based on the process that you have in place now, it identifies these locations so that if there were a problem and they were identified as a problem, the permitted use could be revoked.
That is correct.
Okay. And then the second issue that I've had a lot of discussion about is parking. I've had a lot of people talk about that. And I want to ask this question. If my daughter were to come home from college and spend the summer at my home and park on the street, there would be nothing precluding her from, for a period of 2.5 to 3 months, from parking on the public street while she lived with me during the summer. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Mr. Mayor, those are all my questions at this time.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Barnett, you had a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. So along the same line of Tim's question, on page 5 of the staff report, it talks about the MUP can be revoked only if there's fraud or misrepresentation. And I asked Steve this question because I understand what those two things mean, but complaints fall under that as well. So noise or trash or anything else.
That is correct. The development code and the municipal code do have regulations for both noise, refuse, that sort of thing. If they're actually found to be not in compliance with that, other actions would be taken in order to bring them into compliance. You could, the permit could still be revoked upon, as you said, fraud, misrepresentation, or operating outside of the confines of the permit.
Okay.
That can be read a number of different ways. Having more people than are permitted stay at one time, renting out more than the identified number of rooms, other things to that effect.
And so that would all be complaint-driven, correct?
That would be correct.
Okay. And then how would that work? Would it be if we received one complaint, if we received 5 complaints?
Not to my recollection, no.
Okay. Do you visit the properties for, I imagine, probably vacation rentals? You visit the properties, but not necessarily for the homestays?
Typically, when we're processing the plot plan review, staff does do a site investigation, whether that means standing out front and looking around at the property owner's home and actually taking a look inside. That's done by the Planning Division staff prior to approval. With regard to the interior premises, we were talking about that earlier, and it would typically be appropriate to add a condition of approval that the interior of the home be reviewed by the building official to make sure there's no outstanding code compliance issues. However, that would be a one-time shot at the time of permit approval, unless the council decided that they wanted more annual building inspections, in which case we'd have to do a further code modification.
Okay, so that's, as it's written now, staff will visit the property once, initially, inside the property to look for code violations, and then not again after that, sort of. And is that sort of the same thing we do with a bed and breakfast, probably?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, okay. I think those are all my questions. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
Yep, I had two questions. This has to do with the constant, the possibility of concentration. We talked about this earlier, and the possibility that HOAs could actually be the enforcement mechanism. And reviewing this with the city attorney, they could technically, but they would require every single person in the HOA would have to approve it, including the affected member. So I am curious if you've done any research with the county related to have they had problems with their concentration rule. Has anybody challenged it as being, you know, unequal use of their land to somebody next door just because they happen to be first, which you discussed in the staff report, but I wonder if they've had any issues with that at all.
Not to my knowledge, no.
And anybody else who's used that kind of a concentration?
No.
Okay. The second question, this one came just because I happened to be searching around recently. What happens with, let's say you have a renter who, and in fact, this is fairly common, I guess, in a lot of urban areas where the renter is actually the home share host. Do we deal with that exactly essentially the same way, or owner-occupied?
Okay. Yeah. So the home stay, as defined, as proposed to be defined, does require owner the owner to occupy the home. So it kind of precludes a renter from doing it. However, that doesn't mean that a renter wouldn't start, in which case that would be a code enforcement issue.
And then, actually, this was just raised by, when we're talking about someone who might have their vacation rental license revoked, what you're talking about is essentially the same process that we would deal with, you know, a particularly loud neighbor or you know, it's essentially the same, it's actually a pretty extensive process in order to get to revocation. It's not, I think you guys might be making it sound a little simpler than it is.
No, you are correct. It is, it does involve investigation, it involves a public hearing, it involves staff time and resources, so it's not an easy takeaway, but there is a process in place outlined in the code for that.
And is that your, you know, the level, is there, I mean, in a sense, when you're talking about an investigation or anything into a home, for instance, when we've had a hoarder problem, we've actually ended up having to take a trusteeship. Is that really the same thing we're talking about? Ultimately, we're taking a trusteeship or something in order to enforce this?
The permit holder is entitled to the same due process rights that they receive when getting the permit, that neighbors would get when getting the permit. So it's a full-blown hearing to revoke a permit. You have to have evidence in the record. It's pretty much the same thing as getting the permit. Taking it away requires a show of evidence and findings, very specific.
So it's just a planning
It can happen at the Planning Commission, subject to appeal to the council.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Costello, you had a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to go back and follow up on some of the earlier questions. Could a noise complaint, you know, we talked about that being a complaint-driven process, but could a noise complaint generate an on-site visit that went to an internal inspection? Earlier you said we do one-time inspection when the permit is applied for. That would be the time we go in and do an internal inspection. But could a complaint lead to us going in and doing an additional internal inspection?
Theoretically, it could. Again, we would be looking at the operation and compliance with the performance standards that are written into the permit. These include, you know, noise provisions and refuse for the performance standards. I wouldn't expect
we obtained the permit.
doesn't that make for a pretty quick process?
That would be pretty obvious.
Thank you.
Okay. You know, Matthew, you covered it, and I know the Mayor Pro Tem, I don't know if you asked a question, I thought I heard it, but could you clarify on the concentration limitation? You indicated that other jurisdictions have done that, the county, so on and so forth. What is staff recommending with regard to concentration limitations at this time?
If it's the will of the council to include a concentration limitation, staff would be in support of a limit based on the linear distance from an existing established homestay or vacation rental. 300 feet is typically the noticing requirement that we do for public hearings, and it would be the case on vacation rentals that we notice property owners within 300 feet. So if it's the will of the council to go that way, staff would suggest a linear distance of 300 feet from all property boundaries. The county, actually, they have different for Cambria and for Cayucas, but they have different larger distances for operations on the same side of the street, smaller on the opposite side of the street, and then an even smaller distance all the way around the building. In the interest of just being consistent, staff would recommend a 300-foot radius.
Any other questions? All right, this is a public hearing, and I'm wagering that at least one or two of you will probably want to get up and speak. Here are the ground rules. We do anticipate a number of speakers, so we are going to be mindful of the three-minute rule. Don't feel bad if I have to cut you off. There's also nothing wrong with indicating in your presentation that your feelings or thoughts are substantially the same as a speaker who spoke before you. And that way we can get through the public comment period, but you are entitled to your full 3 minutes. We would like you to come to the podium, state your name and your place of residence. So once again, this is the public hearing portion. Anyone who would like to come forward, please do so.
My name is Jennifer Swift, and I live in Aurora Grandy off James Way. And I spoke here once before. I don't like the whole idea of this, and it's like everything I've heard has just made it worse. Why would we put our communities that have families and that bought homes in nice areas to raise their families, why would we even put them through this whole ordeal that if their next-door neighbor was allowed to do that, and then, okay, they had a complaint, there's noise or too much parking. Why should they be the ones that have to suffer? They went into a neighborhood where they knew they could raise their kids and be safe. We don't know what kind of people these people are going to be renting to, their vacation stays, whatever you want to call it. They could be pedophiles. There's no place saying that they have to fill out an application, that the neighbors have to be told who they are, what they look like, what kind of cars they're driving. And it's just putting so much danger in a nice neighborhood families. I mean, they spend a lot of money on these homes in Aurora Grandy. And they shouldn't have to be subject to that. You talk about tourism. There's plenty of hotels. And if we take that away by letting them stay in our homes, then what the hotels are going to be suffering. And I'm just totally against it. And that's what I have to say. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Okay. My name is Robin Rinsler, and I put together a little presentation to try to answer some of the problems, homestay and vacation rentals, and how this will be beneficial to our community. What did I do wrong? So what are the concerns? We've heard that traffic is one of the concerns, but we wanted to say that it's not as much as when kids are home from college. Many hosts do allow parking in the driveway. Guests usually arrive in one car. And it's no different than if friends or family come to visit. And it's also no different than if a room is rented for more than 30 days. Regarding noise, it is obviously less than when kids are home from college. It's not more than if friends or family come to visit. Airbnb guests want a good review from hosts. It's not more than if rented out for more than 30 days. And another concern was stranger danger. What we do know is that statistics show that child abusers know their victims. These are people like coaches. Unlikely we'd be inundated with new hosts, but AG hosts do support the city in placing a cap on the number of vacation rentals or homestays allowed. The advantages of homestays and vacation rentals versus couch surfing, renting for more than 30 days, inviting friends to stay and inviting family to stay. The advantages are the income does help with mortgage payments, keeps neighborhoods looking great with landscaping, paint, and other repairs and maintenance. It employs many local people. We hire gardeners, house cleaners, repair people, remodeling contractors to keep our houses looking really nice. The only differences are that the city of Arroyo Grande will receive income in the form of fees and taxes. Vacation rentals and homestay owners are more motivated to maintain a beautiful exterior and interior. This increases property values for the entire neighborhood.
Robin, we're going to have to ask you to wrap up.
We're done. That's perfect timing.
Okay, good timing. Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening, Mayor. I'm Shirley Volpatti from Arroyo Grande.
Excuse me just one second, please. The signs are distracting folks. If you could please keep them down. Go ahead.
I live on Hillcrest Drive in Arroyo Grande. This whole situation upsets me. I think we live in a free country. We have freedom of speech. And now we have too many rules and regulations in our world already. And now we're going to put more rules and regulations on our citizens here in Arroyo Grande. You can't have this. You can't have that. You have to have this. It worries me. Because Big Brother is going to watch us pretty soon. And if we don't keep an even level with all these rules and regulations, anybody would love to come down here and visit, and you have an extra room. Well, I can't rent it to you. You can't stay with me because I don't have a permit. You're going to go through this whole terror shootings, anybody that comes into your world, anywhere. We just have to live and be happy and live with each other and trust one another and trust those in our neighborhood that rents to somebody that we can't live with. And if we can't do that, we're in trouble. Because where are we when we have too many rules? And I'm sorry, I'll come to any meeting in the world about more rules. Thank you for listening.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else who would like to come forward?
Good evening. My name's Diane Puhak, and I wanted to thank you, Michael. Is that right? Matt, I'm sorry. He was really helpful to me when I've gone in a couple times. I live in Arroyo Grande, although my vacation rental is in the village, and I just wanted to say that the past two people who've come through have been, one was, two were nurses that have assisted at Marianne Hospital, traveling nurses, and in their young 20s, yes, they get to park in the driveway. They've been delighted with the area and excited to help out at the hospital, and currently I have a doctor there that's assisting at Arroyo Grande Medical Hospital, and she's a neurosurgeon helping, and so it's been a fantastic experience. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Yes, I'm Audrey Howard, and I live at 996 Robin Circle.
I'm standing. Could you pull that mic a little bit in front of you?
Sure.
There you go. Thanks.
Okay. Let me say my name again. No.
Please.
Audrey Howard. I live at 996 Robin Circle. Can you hear better now?
That's good.
Okay. I'm standing here in serious opposition to the proposed ordinance regarding vacation rentals, or homestays as they are known. I predict if this ordinance is passed, it will eventually change the character of each and every neighborhood in our very desirable city. A group of us recently canvassed our neighborhood to gather signatures against this plan. What we discovered is that most of them had never heard of it. We had to explain that this resolution would allow anyone to rent the bedrooms in their homes to transients from anywhere in the world for a period of from 1 to 14 days. That was my understanding at the time. Just like a motel. These renters are found on internet websites such as Airbnb. Many of the people we explained this to were outraged at the idea and outraged at the fact that they had never heard of it, even though this plan has been in process for months. Short-term rentals of the bedrooms in your home is a business. And because it's a business, it has no place in a residential neighborhood any more than a McDonald's would. Think about it. Parking would increase. Traffic would increase. Trash would increase. The noise level would increase. Water usage would increase. I believe that much more should be learned before we take the good people of Arroyo Grande down this irreversible path. Your decision of this ordinance is huge. You owe it to the people of our precious hometown to thoroughly investigate all the ramifications. I beg you to err on the side of caution, as there will be no putting the genie back in the bottle. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate the comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi, my name's Peggy Thayer. I am a resident of San Luis Obispo and have been since 1971. I was a Cal Poly student, stayed, I work from home. I have a business in my home. So I also do Airbnb, so it's also a business. There's a lot of people that do businesses in their homes, piano teachers. I can, you know what I mean. So the fact that this is a business that doesn't belong in the home is ridiculous. We were very involved with getting this ordinance passed in San Luis Obispo. And all the same things were brought up about traffic, noise, and what's the other one? Safety. I think you've heard, and I agree with the lady that spoke about that these things are just, it's just not true. You have one car. I have more noise from the four girls who live in the house and are students that live behind me than I'd have ever had from any of my guests. I called the police on them twice last week. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have of why we were able to get it passed in San Luis Obispo. And I encourage you to allow this in Arroyo Grande. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi. How you doing? My name is Doug Gager. I live at 400 Allen Street in Arroyo Grande. And when I read about this in the newspaper, I decided to look at Airbnb and VRBO and HomeAway. And everything has already happened. All these rentals are already here. There's only less than 30 rentals in all of Arroyo Grande. So everybody's fear is the way it is right now. Nobody's going to, if you don't want to rent your room now, you're not going to rent your room just because you've heard about this or you're allowed to rent your room or your house for, a week at a time. Everything is all in place. So when I looked at these websites, I recognized four houses there was two of them in the very neighborhood that I live in, and there's two other ones that are close by, so I drove by every single one of these houses. They are as neat as you can imagine. They're absolutely perfect, every single one of them. And most of the time, I would say that these rooms are probably booked on average maybe 100 days a year. So there's not people there 365 days a year. So there's not the traffic that you would be thinking or the water use that people are afraid of. And they're not going to rent to anybody that, there's going to be a rental agreement. They're going to know who these people are. They're not just going to rent to anybody. they have to qualify, and so that's my point. And also in looking at them, I just jotted down a couple things, and one of them said the location of this house is wonderful, and there's a great meat store with delicious tri-tip sandwiches. The stroll into the town was amazing. You walk across a little bridge, and as well as wine tasting and places and nice restaurants. So that was from a place right here, and obviously these people came into town, walked here, and spent their money. And I noticed that every listing had house rules on Airbnb, and one of them was, this house is in a neighborhood. All outdoor activities should be quiet. It's important to be respectful. And if you look at these websites, every single rule, they all have rules. They don't. None of them say, yeah, it's okay to party, or it's okay, to have 10 cars and, a bunch of people. I think Arroyo Grande is different than people that rent at the beach and they pack the places full of houses. People come here for a different reason. They come here to go to the restaurants, visit the village, go to the winery.
Fix it up really nice. And I have to tell you what, it's been a positive experience. I tell you what, I've run into people from all over the world. I've run into a couple of my neighbors and their families when they come to town for holidays, Thanksgiving. I screen the renters very carefully and have had very, very positive feedback from my neighbors. It seems the city is focused on Airbnb, but there is 10 other popular websites that I know of that can rent your house out as a vacation rental. I chose Airbnb because they have a really good website that allows you to choose the screeners, so I can be particularly careful who I rent in the house. Renting the house for 1 or 2 weeks per month has allowed me to make significant improvements on the property. It's allowed me to get a housekeeper, a gardener, and help with maintenance. And it most importantly allows me and my wife to come up and spend the rest of the time when it's not booked and stay here in Rio Grande. Compared to neighboring cities, the regulations recommended by the Planning Commission, I feel, are very strict and expensive for property owners. I'm not objecting to them, but the process becomes more burdensome, expensive, I will likely have to rent the home out on a monthly basis, which will actually have more impact on the neighborhood, less oversight, and no city revenue. I do believe the responsible vacation rentals have a very positive impact in our community, particularly local businesses, and with reasonable ordinance in place, it will be a great thing for the city's revenue. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Thank you for your comments.
Good evening. My name is Jenny Shaheen, and I reside at 575 Heritage Lane in Arroyo Grande. And I've been here a couple of different times speaking in opposition to this. And the idea that the two gentlemen just presented before me, it sounded amazing. I wanted to sign up. I wanted to go. Sounded like a commercial review to me. The problem is that we're discussing residential neighborhoods. In addition to the familiar concerns that you've heard from almost everyone, mine comes from a professional real estate background. My concern is, I don't know this to be true or the future, it's just my concern, is property values. There's been a lot of assumption as to what will affect traffic, noise, and safety. But California law requires, as an agent, that any seller disclose a material issue to a would-be buyer. Do buyers want to live next door to a B&B? Do they have 3 months of this to, vet a process to decide whether how it's going to impact them, or are they just going to get that disclosure and say, I don't know, I think I'm going to go with the one across town. I do believe it could affect property values of the neighboring homes. I feel like it's going to severely limit a buyer pool. If I end up being the minority here and the city goes ahead with this ordinance, I remain confused why the city would reduce the business fees associated with running a business in one's home, much like the woman said, it's a business like any other. I don't know what all those fees are, but if you're going to compete with our local hotels that have a certain bar that must be met financially, I don't understand why the city would reduce that. Clearly, it is a lucrative business. Otherwise, I can't imagine why my neighbors would open their doors to people. There was mention in the slideshow of a land use, 1210.1, I'm not sure what that is. It talked about parking and how to gauge that. I believe there's only five
that I heard in our last meeting, five in our neighborhood right now that are operating as this. So I don't know how we gauge that it's going to be a problem. I don't think it's going to be a floodgate. I don't think we're going to pass this and everyone's going to go, I want to do it. But I think there's been a lot of press, and I think it's growing, as this gentleman said. It's everywhere. It's here. It's now. It's going to grow. And much like Audrey Howard said, you let the genie out of the bottle. I wouldn't do it very, very broad. And then if there's a problem, try to reduce it down, because much like you said, it might be very difficult to take away permissions already given. The one thing I would say about the parking and noise and how they are different from families and college students is that the current homeowners pay hefty property taxes for the rights for their children to come to their home and their friends and family to come to their home. That's their right as property owners. And lastly, in closing, I'm a little disappointed, having sat at the back of the room, when someone in opposition did bring up something of concern. Maybe it sounded alarming to say stranger danger or whatever those scary things are to people who don't know. But the snickering that came from the people who are in favor of this did not give me confidence that my concerns are real to them. It made me feel like, you know, people were rolling their eyes and snickering. And I guess I don't respect that when this is a real concern to our neighbors. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your comments.
Good evening. My name is Pete Evans, and I'm a slow host. I've been hosting Airbnb for 8 months or so. And I'd like to comment on a lot of the comments you've heard tonight. And I guess I'll start with the last one about the snickering about the stranger danger, because we have in San Luis. I believe this lady mentioned that we find our guests on various websites, and that isn't the case. They find us. We never seek out guests. Guests seek out hosts. And as it's been pointed out, and I'm sure your staff knows well, especially through Airbnb, guests and hosts are vetted. We have to send them a copy of our license. We have to prove we own the property. The guests are all vetted. They have to show who they are to Airbnb before they can even become a member and then enter into this process. Therefore, if there's a problem, we can all be found and tracked easily, much more so than some casual 30-day renter. Anyway, I do appreciate the time. I could comment on everything you've heard tonight, especially the negatives, because we have met and dispelled all of those unfounded fears in San Luis Obispo. And it is true that the staff report is more, not punitive, but more strict than what we are probably going to end up with in San Luis Obispo. I will join the two former speakers who urge you to give less regulation a little attention as well as more. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi, I'm Kathy Johnson. I live on Robin Circle in Arroyo Grande. I have a couple of concerns about this issue. One is how little information is out there about it. In talking to people in our neighborhood, so many people didn't know anything about it, including myself, until just recently. And I'm still researching it, trying to understand it. And that concerns me, that something so important is going on and there's so little information out there. But I want to say we moved here 15 years ago, and we spent 8 months looking for just the right neighborhood. And I think we found it. We've loved it. We've lived there for 15 years. But we intentionally chose that neighborhood because it was a small residential neighborhood. We avoided areas that were mixed use. Okay, they had apartment buildings and things like that for that very reason. I share the concerns of the realtor about my property value. I'm really not afraid of people renting, but I am afraid of the largest investment I've ever made being impacted. That is a concern. I guess in closing, I would just say I see this as benefiting a few people, but impacting many people. So it may be their home, but it's our neighborhood, and it's a big concern. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi, my name is Paul Rinsler. I live at 509 Game Fair. So you've heard concerns, and I'm a Airbnb host. You've heard concerns, and it is certainly your job to balance concerns against benefits. And I'd suggest to you that the way to balance that is not to deny the ordinance. The way to balance it, which the hosts approve of, is to put concentration limits on. And through that process, if there is a problem, if the concerns that the opponents have talked about, if they come to fruition, which many people, many hosts' opinion is that they won't come to fruition, but if they do, then you have a mechanism to take care of that issue. And I suggest that that's the way to balance these two opposing sides. A couple of people have mentioned that they lived in the neighborhoods and they didn't even know this was going on. I would suggest that that means that the impacts will be minimal if it's already happening and even the neighbors don't know that this is going on. That speaks to an incredibly minimal, actually, a no impact. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi, good evening. I'm Marianne Culver, and I live in San Luis Obispo, and my husband and I have been hosts for 2 years. We really enjoyed the experience. I just want to kind of share a little bit about that, is that we've hosted a nurse that relocated. We've hosted just recently somebody that found a job here from Denver and relocated and found a home. So we've had the pleasure of welcoming 4 or 5 members to our community that were very grateful to establish themselves. Somebody was waiting for escrow to close, so they wanted 3 weeks. You know, and so that type of thing, there's definitely a little niche for that and a need. And I really want to distinguish between, a short-term rental and a longer stay, and also that a vacation rental by owner is a whole nother thing. It's a totally different scenario when the owners aren't present. For us, it's enabled us to pay tuition at UCSB.
Are you living there at the time?
I'm living in a house, and the person across the street from me has 5 bedrooms.
It would be 2 if
you're going to allow him 5 cars?
I'm sorry?
You're going to allow him 5 cars because he's got a 5-bedroom house.
I think the definition that we're working with here is the homestay currently. We haven't yet discussed it, but the homestay is...
Let me finish, please.
It's defined as a maximum right now of 2 rooms. Okay, a maximum of 2 rooms.
That's great, 2 rooms. But right. When you have 5 rooms and you got 5 cars and then friends come over, I brought my RV home Saturday to unload it. I have no place to park in front of my own house. My daughter gets out at 10:30 at night. From work at night, and she's got to park over in the neighbor's yard. And, you know, okay, if you want to have rentals, but we've got to come up with some rules. Sometimes I get up in the morning, there's 8 cars sitting out in front. You're only allowed like 8 or 9 people there because you've got 5 bedrooms, but these people getting out of their cars, sometimes 5 of them get out of the car at one time. I mean, the house must have 15 people in there with all these people getting out. So, like I said, you got to have some rules. You just can't just open it up to what it is, because right now, of course, I have someone here said, oh, well, that's public. They can park on the front of their street. Well, you know, I think that's saying something stupid. I asked him, how would he like if his front of his house was constantly having parking in front? And another thing, too, wouldn't want to buy a house if the house across the street would have 6 cars every day. I wouldn't want to sell anybody a house, or I wouldn't want to buy one. So I'm just saying, I think we've got to look at these rules. It's great. 2 rooms, that's great. Then that way you wouldn't have all this traffic to worry about if you would have 2 rooms. But there's people out there got 4 or 5 rooms, and they're going to have 12 cars sitting out front. You know, when you rent one of some of these rooms, I don't care what these people are saying. When you rent a room, 3 or 4 rooms, and you say, well, you can only have 8 people there, believe me, you're not going to have just 8 people there. They're going to be 15 people there. That's the way most people rent it. They pay a ridiculous price for those rooms, so they're going to have their share of area. That's, like I said, I'm just hoping if this goes through that you guys come up with some good rules, because right now, all the traffic that I got in my yard, that I can't even, my friends, neighbors ask me, what do? You have a party every weekend? I said, no, those are rentals. They're not my friend's cars. My friend has to park, when they come over, they park down the street. So, like I said, if you guys want to go through with it, you better have a lot of rules, because good rules, like I said, hey, only 2-bedroom, that's great. Then you can only have a couple of cars. I think that's great, but if you these people come up with 4 or 5 bedrooms, they're going to have 6, 7, 8 cars, you know, especially on Fridays and Saturday nights. Friends come over, you know, and then they tell me, oh, there's not that many people staying here. I take my dog for a walk at 11 o'clock, and I go out there at 7 o'clock, and I count the cars, and there's still 8 cars out there.
Okay. Thank you for your comments, okay. John. Appreciate it.
That's what I wanted to say.
Okay. Thank you. Next speaker, please.
Good evening. Claire Vollmer. I live in Aurora Grande. I don't know where to start. You know, fear of the unknown is a wonderful thing. I think a lot of us who are professing to be against this are really not familiar with it. They don't have any personal experience with it. And I also fear that we have some backlash from a lot of what's gone on in San Luis Obispo with regard to student rentals and some of the neighborhoods up there, which is a totally different breed of cat. I've been on both sides of this hosted thing for the last 4 or 5 years. I've traveled and used VRBO and Airbnb across the United States. I have hosted. And what the norm is, believe it or not, is typically professional people. It's usually a couple. It might be a single person and their child. It's not the raging 8 to 10 people and lots of cars and lots of noise and all of those things. At least that's not been my experience. It's been a joy to meet people from other areas and introduce them to our community and let them learn to appreciate it and leave their dollars here. Thank you very much. So there's an upside to that, too. So it's not been that kind of an experience for me, and I can tell you where I first heard it. A really nice connotation for me, and I think we are in an economic condition right now where people need to be creative. They need to survive. And we should have a certain set of rights as private property owners as long as we do not cause harm to our neighbors, cause a disruption in the community, and we follow the rules. So I think there's a lot of fear of the unknown going on here, and I just have to tell you I've had a wonderful experience with it. Met lots of great people, and of course it's my home, so I have some very serious rules, and the people that I've rented from have had the same thing. The properties are beautifully maintained, because if they weren't, they wouldn't be rented. So I think there's a good side to it. Truthfully, I have to tell you that I think this one more layer of government and a solution, you will, is one that's looking for a problem. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hi. sorry for my voice being gone. I've been sick the last week, but I'm hopefully better. My name is Joe Clayman. We inherited a house here in 2010 from my wife's stepmother. She was a hoarder. The house looked a little bit like the Addams family. I've spent my life as a designer, an environmental designer, practicing architecture. We completely gutted the house, redid it. We've won your Rio Grande Beautification Award, et cetera, et cetera. We've had wonderful experience. We have families that basically meet. Half of them live in the Bay Area. Half of them live down south. They meet in the middle. As I said, it's been a great experience. We get wonderful feedback from people. John is my neighbor across the street, and we're actually friends, believe it or not. I like John very much. He's a very nice fellow, and I understand his concerns. there is a parking issue. Even though there's a lot of parking, we can put three people in our driveway. We can put two or three in front of our house. And then there's a lot of parking across the street, which is in front of John's house. I've asked people not to park there, and I guess I haven't been as adamant as I should be in it, John. I really apologize for that, and we're going to try to work that out because apparently people do park across the street. So we charge a $1,500 security deposit, and we're going to enforce that, and part of that's going to be if they park across the street, they're going to be penalized for that, and that money I'd be happy to even give to John if that happens. So I'm really sorry, John. We're going to try to work it out for you.
Joe, if you could address the council, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So at any rate, as I said, it's been a very positive experience for us. We get, we get wonderful people coming who love the city. Also, we get a lot of people who are just friends, who come up, friends and family who come up. So that's about half of what we get. Anyway, that's really all I have to say. And again, I apologize to John, and we're going to really try hard to make that better for him. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Hello. I just want to make two quick points.
Will you get your name, please?
Andrew Wurderitz. Just from the perspective of a young and rambunctious youth, if I want to go somewhere and be really loud and have a good time, I'm not going to go into somebody's home. I would go to a hotel or a motel where nobody really cares what I'm doing. Concerning the property value, these hosts are competing with each other to attract guests, so they're going to try and make their houses look as nice as possible. So it seems to me all that would really do is increase the property values. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please. Okay, I knew we had at least one more.
This is very brief. I just
can I get to get you to pull
I was
that
not
back
even intending to speak, but I just have a lot of questions about this, and my concern has been.
Excuse me, can we get your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry, Betty DePaul. I live at 884 Robbins Circle, Aurora Grande. And up to this point, I've loved Aurora Grande, but now I'm beginning to wonder because we have a beautiful neighborhood, and I have always considered it residential, and now we're having businesses mingled in, with everybody else. So I mean, and they turned it down, and I wonder if our planning commission has any idea why. It could be the fact that they have all so many hotels in Pismo Beach, but we also have some hotels, not to the extent that they do. And I have another question regarding the breakfast, including with the B&B or homestay, and I was wondering if the health department has been contacted in regards to that. I don't know. I just am a deep thinker, and I guess I'm trying to just let you know how much time I've spent thinking about this and how unhappy I am with it. I am just totally disappointed with this project. And I don't think that the money is going to make that big of a difference because you're going to have to hire somebody to take care of the money. You're going to have to spend money hiring somebody to take care of the money and the checkups and so forth. So, I mean, money is good, but I don't see this as a big money maker. Thank you all for your time.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
My name is Eve Newhouse, and I'm an Airbnb host in San Luis Obispo. I'd like to just talk a little bit about my experience and the kind of people that I have in my house. I've been doing it for over 2 years. I've had over 300 guests. I've only had to write a bad review once, and that was for a couple of young people who didn't bother to talk to me and who left the room with the sheets on the floor and trash on the floor. The rest of my guests have been Europeans, professionals, artists, Hollywood people. It's a sort of upper middle class phenomenon, to be honest. The review system doesn't allow the kind of people that that neighbors are afraid of, because they just it just once you get a bad review, nobody ever lets you stay in their house again, because these are our houses. I give these people a key to my house. So I think that the fears around it are unfounded. And I think that my experience with it is that I now have a housekeeper. I have put new windows in the bottom of my house. I repaired a hole in the roof. I paid the taxes. Now I'm paying TOT to San Luis Obispo. I'm paying about $200 a month to the city of San Luis Obispo. I've sent innumerable people to restaurants. I keep a list. I have a guide to San Luis Obispo, which I wrote myself, and I leave on my desks. And then the people go to restaurants in San Luis Obispo. They spend their money. I just haven't seen the downside of it in the 2.5 years that I've been doing it. So I just wanted to share my personal experience with you, and I hope that you will pass the ordinance. I think it's well thought out. I think the limitations are smart. I think you're doing the ordinance that you're looking at is a very good one. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Last chance.
Good evening. My name is Michael Howard. I'm on Robin Circle. I'm a few seconds over 3 minutes, but bear with me. So what is the rub? Why is homestays a bad idea? I am not opposed to vacation rentals. I am opposed to homestays. The rub, ladies and gentlemen, is that the relationship between the internet as we know it today and the desirability of the area in which we live. When you equate the number of people who want to visit our area and add in the accessibility that the internet provides to those individuals, you are creating a very tempting environment financially, not only for the potential traveler, but more importantly, the potential host. Today, Expedia.com lists 86 hotels near and around Pismo for a weekend in June at an average rate of $200 per night. Now, if I rent my guest bedroom out just two nights per week at $100 per night, I pocket $1,000 a month in income. I've undercut the hotels by a wide margin, so my guests should be plentiful. How many people do you know who would take advantage of an opportunity to make an extra $1,000 or more per month? A lot. How many hotel tourists that visit our area do you think would like to save $100 per night and stay in a nice, peaceful, residential neighborhood? Many. Now, if our town was Sweet Home, Texas, it probably wouldn't have much. Wait. Wait and see how other cities like ourselves deal with this brand new concept in the internet age, and most of them are struggling on how to do just that. If we do decide down the road that we want to change our minds, we can. Two, allow homestays in mixed-use zones and rural residential zones only, but keep them out of the residential neighborhoods where they do not belong. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, and you were under 3 minutes. Okay. All right. Next speaker, please.
Good evening. My name is Gay Grooms. I live in Arroyo Grande, and I'm one of the hosts. I wanted to recap a few points. One, there is an economic benefit to the city to approving this code amendment. It isn't huge, but it's substantial. We estimate, based on last year's stays for the five hosts...
Gay, can you pull that mic over closer to you? Thank you.
We estimate for the five hosts within the city limits of Arroyo Grande will be paying a minimum of $10,700 in TOT add another $27,000 as a very conservative total of what each guest spends per day during their visit to Arroyo Grande. This includes lunch, dinner, wine, and souvenirs, but doesn't include activities, movies, plays, shopping, gasoline, nor the money that we spend on supplies and local services. If this amendment is not approved, it's unlikely these guests will book hotels. They will more likely look for a similar experience in surrounding communities, and that revenue will go to those communities. To my knowledge, we've heard opposition to this amendment basically from one neighborhood, and there have been no specific complaints, only a fear of what might happen, which seems to be focused on the fear that every home in Arroyo Grande will open its door to strangers. I think that fear is unwarranted. Homestays and vacation rentals operated for 30 years in San Luis Obispo before they were required to pay TOT, and I think they only have about 50 hosts. If we have only 5 hosts within the city limits now, while there is no permit and TOT required, why would there be an explosion after these payments are required? Also, as had been mentioned previously, hosting does require a good deal of work. The house and property always have to be immaculate, and there is additional cleaning and laundry to do. I think young families probably don't have the extra room or time to do this, and retirees probably don't want to. Also, at the first public meeting, Mr. Howard said that he believed his petition with 85% of people opposing this could be extrapolated to the entire city of Arroyo Grande. Although we discussed the lack of validity in these kinds of petitions during the first meeting, let's assume for a minute that his supposition is valid. I think we could then just as logically conclude that if 85% of the city is opposed to homestays, then 85% of the residents won't become hosts. I support the City Council in approving the code amendment regarding vacation rentals and homestays. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Last call. Okay, please.
Good evening. I'm Walt Bethel, and I live at 776 Cardinal Court, which means that Mike Howard and Gay Grooms are my back fence neighbors. I've lived here for 20 years. I really, really like my neighborhood. I think I have as good a claim to value our community as Mike Howard does. Unlike Mike, I don't have any problem at all with homestay rentals. I think before you tell people they can't do something, the burden of proof is on you to provide solid factual evidence that what those people want to do will cause harm. And those who don't like homestay rentals haven't provided that. All they've shown us is opinion, speculation, and emotional rhetoric. Here's what I mean by solid factual evidence. We don't let people text and drive, even though they want to, because we know it causes accidents. This isn't someone's opinion, it isn't speculation, it isn't how someone happens to feel. It's uncontroversial, cold fact. And again, the people who don't like homestay rentals haven't shown us anything comparable. They speculate that bad things might happen if the community has homestay rentals. There might be wild parties, debris in the streets, parking problems, bad people roaming our neighborhood, and changes to the kind of community we all enjoy. As I told Mike one evening, any human activity can go wrong. But speculation that something might happen isn't evidence that it will happen. Those bad things could happen, or not, whether there are homestay rentals or not, and these people haven't shown us that homestay rentals would make these bad things more likely. They don't know, and ignorance is not evidence. Something else we get from the opponents of homestay rentals is a lot of emotional rhetoric. Here's an example from yesterday's Tribune. Maybe some of you saw it. It's a direct quote attributed to Mike Howard. Quote, allowing homestay visits is basically giving a green light to every single resident in the city to essentially turn their house into a hotel. This isn't evidence of anything.
Bill from San Luis Obispo, and I'm a host in San Luis, and I've been doing it for about 6 months. And I'm here to say I'm not going to do it anymore. Not because it's a bad thing. I love the guests that I've had. They've been fabulous. They've left my house in immaculate condition. None of my neighbors have complained. It's a lot of work. I have become the cleaning woman. My house is immaculate all the time. I don't need it that clean, so I'm constantly making it clean, hoping there's not a speck of dust anywhere. So for those people who think that anybody and everybody's going to start doing it because they can, it's a lot of work. Thank you.
Thanks for your comments. Anyone else? Last chance. Going once, twice, three times. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing portion of 9A, and we're going to bring this back to the council. And we will start on my left with Councilmember Barnage.
This is my birthday. Can we take a short break? 5 minutes.
After a 5 minute necessity break, we will begin with council comments then. All right, council's in a short recess. All right, if we could get you to take your seats, please. Council's going back in session. All right, council is back in session, and we have concluded the public hearing portion of this item, and we are now going to go to council comments, and we're going to start with Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I have two follow-up questions. First, if I can ask staff those questions. Matt, the reduced fees that the speaker Jenny was talking about early on, do you know what she was referring to?
Originally, when staff had developed the proposal for a conditional use permit, conditional use permits run approximately $3,600. So the reduced fee would be bringing it down to the minor use permit at $416.
The $416. Right. And then you're confident that the $416 covers staff time to process that MUP, correct?
That's correct. Because it doesn't. There's no public hearing involved. There's no mailers that go out other than for vacation rentals when a decision is made on the project.
Okay. And then my other question was about the cap, limiting the number of rentals. The one that you staff recommends, if we do decide to go with something like that, is the 300 feet. Have you talked about how many rentals or what other cities are doing to limit? I mean, what are the numbers that we're looking at or thinking about?
In terms of overall permits or distance?
Well, the distance you talked about was with. Well, why don't you just expand on that? Oh, my pen just fell apart. Why don't you just expand on that for me?
Distance would be. Staff would recommend if council desires a concentration limit of 300 feet, based measured from the property boundary of the home. This is consistent with our public hearing notice requirements. So we think it'd be a good compromise. Not too strict, not too lenient type of thing. Communities, I only recall one in North Carolina that had a larger distance requirement, and it was 500 feet. But in staff's opinion, that's a little wide.
Okay. Thank you for that. So we've been hearing about this for a while. And I've really given it a lot of thought, and I have a lot of personal experiences to share. I won't make you stay here forever, but one thing I did 2 months ago when we first heard about this, because we thought it was coming to the council a lot earlier than it has come, is I Googled, or I went on Airbnb, because I know it's not Airbnb, it's also Homestays, it's also VRBO, but I went on the Airbnb website just to look at the statistics to see how many people are out there that do this, how many rentals there are, how many guests. Now, just with Airbnb, it was founded in 2008. They have 118,000 places for rent in the U.S., and they have 11 million guests approximately worldwide. So then what I did was, because I had no idea if these fears were founded or unfounded, so what I did was I Googled nightmare Airbnb stories, because people use that when something bad happens. I Googled pet homes in Arroyo Grande. So essentially, maybe 90, and I'm just guessing, 90% of all residents in Arroyo Grande could rent out a room because they're living there. And I admit that if this happened, if even 50% of the owner-occupied homes in Arroyo Grande rented out a room, it would change the character of our neighborhood. I wouldn't like it at all. I wouldn't be happy with that at all, having 50% of the homes on my street with people I didn't know, more cars, more traffic. That would definitely be like something that I see when I'm down visiting my sister in Hollywood. That's what it feels like. But I think you have to realize that Arroyo Grande is not like L.A. It's not like San Francisco. It's not even like San Luis Obispo. The people that live in Arroyo Grande are senior citizens and families. And most of these people, the demographics here, have no interest in doing this. My parents actually have a cottage on their property. And just recently, their long-term tenant moved out. And they actually considered putting a vacation renter in their property. And they actually really, really thought about it, and they decided to put new wood floors in and go to all this effort. And then my mom said, no way. I do not want to rent out something that's going to have other people come over and over, and I have to change the sheets, and I have to go out there and make sure they're checked in. I won't be able to go out of town. You'll have to come down and check them in, Kristen, and it'll be this nightmare situation, only because of the amount of work. So I even think, and this isn't even in their house, this is a cottage, so it was too much trouble for her. So I really agree that it's a lot of work. You're inviting someone into your home. It's not something that, I mean, I don't even think 90% of people that live in Arroyo Grande are going to want to do it. I really don't. I don't think it's going to spread. I think our demographics don't support it. My sister rents out her house in Hollywood on Airbnb, and as a lot of speakers mentioned, it comes with a lot of oversight. There is a deposit. She only collects $200. I heard someone else say $1,500. That's a lot of money to put forth to come stay for two or three nights in someone's home. She fully investigates who's staying in her house. As someone else mentioned, there's pictures. There's college degrees are mentioned. I mean, there's a lot of information that that Airbnb requests, and my sister follows up and makes sure all of that is valid. They are reviewed, and I would also say that this isn't the type of lodging that I think most people want to stay in. I think I've stayed in Airbnb and VRBO, but that's only because I have pets and I have children. I think a lot of people want to go to a hotel where they have privacy, and they don't want to have someone else in their home checking on them. I think they want to be able to relax and put their feet up. So I don't necessarily think people in Arroyo Grande are going to really want to rent their rooms out in their home, and I also don't think there's as much tourists that are going to want this type of lodging. But there's definitely a need for it, and I admit that. The rooms and the vacation rentals, I looked online, they're not cheap at all. These, you know, it's not $50 to come rent a room. It's a lot more money. The houses can be $500 or $600 a night if you rent a whole vacation home out. And like I always do, I put myself in both persons' shoes, the people for and against this ordinance. And I would like the ability in the future to vacation rent my home for extra income, but I also have two teen daughters, and I thought long and hard about someone in the house next door to me staying there that I didn't know. And I thought that I would probably be more aware and I would notice them, but I don't think it's reason enough to not allow us to have homestays or vacation rentals. I don't think this is going to proliferate and cause a problem. Another speaker mentioned there's lots of places to stay, other places to stay, hotels, and I really disagree with that. I don't think we have enough hotels. I have family come to town, and besides, I'm not going to name any, but there's only a handful of hotels to come stay in. My in-laws who come, they go to Napomo to stay in an Airbnb rental when they come because there's no place around here for them to stay with their dogs. So I think this actually does fill a need for the community. So just to sum up, I'm ready to move forward with this tonight. I think that it's been given a lot of review. We've had two public workshops. I attended one of them. Both the pros and the cons were brought up. It's been in the newspaper. It's been publicly noticed. This meeting that we're having tonight was actually supposed to be 2 weeks ago, and we moved it. So there's been plenty of time for people to know about this, and I would go along with the council's recommendation as far as limiting.
I work in emergency management, and over the past decade, if you're not using social media to communicate with your citizens, your clients, you're way behind the curve, because that's where people get their information. Look what happened to the Boston Marathon. Everybody's tuned in to the different social media to find out what was going on right now, real time, in their neighborhoods. So social media, and I guess if you want to talk about opening the door and you can't go back, well, that's it. Social media is here. We're that door's open and we're not going back. The world is changing. The way people want to vacation is changing. My wife and I, when we vacation, we've used bed and breakfast in the past. We've used bed and breakfast with our children when we traveled internationally. We find it a very, very enjoyable way to travel. And I think that's going to be here also. We're not New York City. We're not San Francisco. And I think that is a very desirable area, and this is a great way for people to come here and see the area. As to who wants to host and be the number of hosts, I'm not at all concerned if we bring this in ordinance into play tonight, if we approve it and go forward, that we're going to have an avalanche of people coming forward that want to host B&Bs. As people have said, it's a lot of work. Vacation rentals and homestays, you have to keep the house clean. It has to be presentable. It has to look like it's a hotel. I don't think the numbers are going to be all that great. It's been free, and we've got five. I think that we're going to have to recognize that this is a phenomena that's going forward. It's here. Whether we want it or not, it's here. I think we're better served to regulate it and to have some sort of sense as to how we're going to permit it and let it be here. A couple of questions I had earlier for staff about being able to go back in and do an internal inspection. It seems like those tools are going to be there for us. But it also sounds like the client base, the people that are going to be using these things, highly disproportionate to being non-troublemakers. I mean, they're professionals. They're people that are going to spend a couple hundred dollars a night to stay in a family situation and experience the family situation, particularly if they're traveling from outside the country, which I think there's a very real chance we'll have a lot of people that do that. I live over near the Casa Grande Hotel, near the Kmart Center. There are busloads of international tourists in there all the time. Germans, Japanese, people come because they're coming here to see Hearst Castle, maybe Yosemite. People come to California because it's a magnificent place. And I think if we can start capitalizing on that, and that's one of the things we're trying to do, is to expand tourism in Arroyo Grande, particularly through the use of the Internet and social media, as ED 6.4 shows. This is playing right into that. We want more people coming here. We want people to come and see this community and experience it. I don't think we're going to be dragging people out of hotel rooms that would be there anyway. We don't have that many hotel rooms. We might end up competing with Pismo Beach for some of the people who want to go over there because they're going to come here because it's nicer and cheaper. Well, that'd be great. The safety issues, I don't think are something that I'm concerned about. The issue that people using these services to get access to homestays, they're going to be researched. They're going to have to provide a lot of information to the system that allows them to participate in it. And I don't think that we really have to worry all that much about sexual deviant looking for a victim using this type of a system to find it. I think I will support the concentration limits of every 300 feet. I think that's a great place to start. I don't know that it's going to necessarily need to be restricted. A matter of fact, if we do that, that's probably going to allow us 1,000 in the city. We're not going to have 1,000 people that come forward to do this. It's too much work. It's too much work. Somebody brought forward the issue that they didn't want to see Big Brother here. Okay, I can understand that, but we exist in a society. We have codes. We have permits. There are allowable uses. If you go into our code book, and I think Tim's got a copy of it over there, the green book, city code, municipal code, you look in that code right now, and that will tell you what uses are permitted in what different kinds of zones. And if you look up residential zones right now, you can have a bed and breakfast again. And if you're violating the rules that have been set up, it may take a little while, but we're going to take your permit away. And that's not going to infringe on your right to have the permit. It's going to validate the rights of all your neighbors to have the city out there looking out for your interests, too. So I'm not concerned about Big Brother. I'm not concerned about property rights. I'm not concerned about this being opening a door and going down a path that's not reversible. That door is already opened. People are going to do this whether we regulate it or not. I think regulating it is a reasonable, prudent thing to do. And I think that by doing that, we may keep a few people out that wanted to do it because they don't want to go through the process of getting a permit. And if you choose to not get a permit and do this anyway, we're going to find you. Because how do your clients find you? They go on the internet and they look up, well, I want to go stay in Arroyo Grande. Well, we looked that up, and I'm sure we could do one of our code enforcement people can do that every week or two, just do a quick check. Well, we've got an address here that's not a permitted use. Let's go check it out. So I think that the system we're trying to put in place here is well thought out. It's a good start. And a year or two from now, if we come back and say, hey, look, there's a lot of problems here we didn't anticipate, we'll change it. And I'll support that. I'll support this tonight, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I come at this from a couple different standpoints. One, I spent 7.5 years on Planning Commission, 4 years on Council. I've raised 5 kids in the village. I've owned a home and I've rented a home. So I have all those different viewpoints to bring to the table. And that's how I come here to this meeting. And I want to mention, first of all, regulation. We don't sit here and look for things to regulate. What happens is they're issue-driven. An issue becomes before Planning Commission or City Council, and that's how we deal with it as it comes. And San Luis is a great example. 30 years with homestays, without any regulation, it becomes an issue. They regulate it 30 years later. We've had these same types of scenarios in Arroyo Grande, and to say we haven't is not to be, you know, intellectually honest. We've had them. It's a question now. It's come to the forefront, and we have to figure out a way to live and let live. The other thing I always hear is property rights. Every man's home is his castle. I don't mean to be sexist, but I'm using the statement. We like to have control over our own homes. So I'd like everybody in this room, regardless of what side you're on the issue, think about what would your opinion be if the shoe were on the other foot. We all want our own property rights, and we don't want somebody infringing on it. That's the basis of America, folks, from way back when, from when we told the Brits to take a hike. So that's a long-standing issue. So that's the regulatory issue. Regarding the looking at the way we screen people, if you rent a home long-term in Arroyo Grande, they have less issues that they can ask you about than Airbnb can. There's so many people that could rent a home from you long-term, and you couldn't ask them the questions you're asking right now. You couldn't do it legally. Sorry, you can't do it. It just can't happen. So you really got to think about this screening process, because I've seen some pretty bad renters that had every legal right to be in the home they were in. The street parking issue, I just don't buy because it's not our parking, it's public parking. We're not guaranteed a spot on the street. We're guaranteed our driveway. If the public has a want and a desire to use the street, they can do that. It's perfectly legal. Somebody said we can't take the genie out of the bottle. Well, I'm sorry, we can. That's what happens. That's how governments work. We can put something in, we can take it out. Do I agree that it's easy? No, it's not easy. I agree with that comment, but it can be done. So I'm fully in favor of the ordinance. I do believe that a concentration section should be put in. I'm totally agreeable with the 300 feet. And I think we should move forward, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Mayor Pro Tem?
Let me just ask one question real quick. On the 300 feet, is that radius or diameter? I assume it's radius. But
the radius from the property boundaries.
So as some of you may know, I'm a hotel operator. And I give you a little hotel perspective here, and I know that there's been strong objection in the hotel, particularly in New York, your roommate is. You're going to be less selective about somebody who's renting a granny unit from you, but you're still going to be very selective because you're right there and because you can exercise some control right at that point. The next step of disengagement would be to be an owner-operator of a rental. You're still going to be fairly engaged because you're going to be selecting the rental directly. And then the least engaged is, of course, someone who's using a property management. And I think that's where you start to see I'd be far more concerned about long-term rentals because you're going to have to deal with them for significant amounts of times if there's a problem compared to a vacation rental or a homestay. So for me, I don't have any concerns about the homestays as a as far as it's the impacts that they may have on the neighborhood. I do have more concerns about vacation rentals. I'll say that some people have talked about this as if it's a new thing. In fact, vacation rentals have been around a very long time, and homestays have been around a fairly long time. It's noted 2008 they started. So there's actually quite a bit known about them. Vacation rentals are frankly where we've heard about most of the problems. Someone had mentioned that Pismo Beach, actually Pismo Beach permits lots of vacation rentals. I'm not quite sure where they are on home shares, but they had to have a lot of vacation rentals and have had some issues with them, and that's what they were reviewing a couple of years ago was where they were going to allow them and where they weren't. So it's really vacation rentals where I think we really should be focused on as far as concentration goes because it'll be the least control. I do think we're going to have a very difficult time with a process that takes away somebody's vacation rental permit once they've got it. I mean, as mentioned, it's really the same kind of action that we take against a homeowner. It's very close to as high a bar in order to be able to revoke their permit. So I do think we want to be particularly careful, personally, I think, with vacation rentals and less concerned about the home shares. So I definitely want to see at least a concentration limit on vacation rentals, and I'm less concerned about it, but I would certainly accept it on home shares if that's the direction the council wanted to go. I'll just say, in general, I think this train's already left the station. And in fact, this is already taking place. It's taking place without, you know, we can get out in front of this and at least have some control over it and at least know where the vacation rentals are and where the home shares are in advance. I do think that the regulations, if that we're putting in place here, this isn't a big profit center for the city, for people who think that we're doing this because we're going to collect a bunch of bed tax. It'd be nice, $10,000 is nice, maybe $20,000 it might get to, but that's not going to make or break the city. This is really about the city getting out in front of a movement before it really overtakes us. So I can support what's in front of us tonight. I would prefer if we're going to use concentration. The reason I asked about the radius question, you know, you start doing that circle on a regular 7,500 square foot lot, and you're talking about, you know, three neighbors both ways, and then going back two streets behind you. You know, at 300 feet, you're not just going to affect the person behind you, but you're actually going to wipe out the person who's on the street behind them. So that's where my concern about the 300 feet, particularly for home shares, comes in. So, like I said, I'm going forward here. I do think I heard the comment about businesses. I think that the comment's already been made that this is a very limited business impact. This is really no different than people who today can actually, you can't open a McDonald's, you can't do a retail operation, but in fact you can turn your kitchen into a bakery today, and you can go out and then sell those at the farmer's market. So there's actually quite a bit of home business potential out there already that these are relatively minor impacts compared to those. So like I said, I'm in favor of what we have in front of us this evening. If we have to get more restrictive later on because, in fact, somehow this takes off, I really doubt we're going to see this take off as a huge business. I'll just say that as the hotel operator, I told you we're fortunate that, yeah, most people don't want to risk have a review. I wish I could write a guest review that said somebody left trash on the floor and the sheets on the floor and be able to write them up. But as I said, we need TripAdvisor.com as well. But that's just not a possibility for us out there. But at any rate, I'm in favor of what we have in front of us this evening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Quick question. Teresa and Matthew, have we looked at, and I'm sure you have, and you may have mentioned it earlier and I missed it, but in terms of the administration of this whole process, what we're bringing forward, how are you viewing that in terms of impact on staff
time? We did do some research on the, I guess, in some of the larger cities there, getting assistance from Airbnb and some of the other organizations as far as identifying those that are participating. We did not find where they're actually collecting the TOT. Since there's different agencies, we actually think that would probably be more cumbersome than the way we do it now. When we found those, mostly were in very large cities where they probably have such high numbers it is beneficial. We would have such low numbers here, and we have a current process in place that's not very labor intensive, and it's working pretty smoothly.
Okay. Well, the reason why I bring that up is there was some comment earlier this evening about problems that were occurring in New York City, and Mayor Pro Tem kind of clarified that same problem was happening in San Francisco. The same problem is currently being addressed in San Diego. So it seems like, you know, more and more of the larger cities in California and on the East Coast seem to be the biggest clients for Airbnb, and so they're continuing to try and negotiate how that process can be streamlined so that it is not an impact on staff, and have Airbnb essentially be the administrators, and those cities get a check from Airbnb, which would obviously benefit us. Not that they're going to rush out and do that for a city of 17,000 people, but I was just curious as to what we have in place to do that. You know, I'm coming at this from a bit of a different perspective, and you know, I've really struggled with this, and I've struggled with it because I can appreciate the argument about people who have invested a significant amount of their assets and well-being into their property, into a neighborhood. And so the whole issue of peace and quiet and tranquility in a neighborhood setting is meaningful to me, as I'm sure it is, you know, for my colleagues. And you know, like some of you have stated when you came to the podium this evening, you know, people did not buy their home in Arroyo Grande neighborhoods with the expectation that a good portion of that neighborhood perhaps, potentially, could become a commercial lodging operation. That's why we have zoning restrictions and so on and so forth. All of that said, I had to stop and think about it, and as has been mentioned, it is clear and it is obvious that we already have these operations occurring in the city, and it's not just with Airbnb. We have people who have homes that are renting to students. They're renting to family members, distant family members. Most of them are handshake agreements. So that it's already occurring. There's been quite a bit of discussion about the safety issue. And I was going to cover this last, but I think I need to kind of add my perspective, not just as a member of the council, but as a former member of the law enforcement community. And that is that people who typically come into a neighborhood to check out their ability or potential to be successful with some form of criminal activity do not typically want to make a record of their presence in that neighborhood as they would if they were to register in a home in that same neighborhood as a tenant. That's just not done. If they're going to case a neighborhood, they come in from the outside and they try and be as quiet and stealth about it as they possibly can. There was talk this evening about the possibility of a compromise, and I'm going to come back to traffic and parking because I do believe that there is a potential impact given the way the proposed revisions to the development code are being put forth. And I realize that it would not be perhaps a regular occurrence. It would not be something that we would see happen all the time. But the potential is certainly there. If you look on page 14, I think, of the staff report, you see the definition of, and it's in there in a couple of different places, you see the definition of homestay as a maximum of two rooms. And the first thing that struck me was, okay, everybody, it's been well established that Arroyo Grande is of three rooms. Is that how it reads, Teresa?
That's correct.
And a thought occurred to me. If I was going to search for a compromise to deal with neighborhood impacts, I guess my preference would be to limit the homestay definition to one room, not two. And if someone desired to have more than one room, then they could pursue perhaps the category of B&B. If we have that definition unwrapped, then maybe we consider classifying a home that decides to rent out two or more rooms as a bed and breakfast, which would then require a bit more administrative and perhaps regulatory oversight. So if you consider that, there's been talk about concentration limitations, but if you consider kind of scaling back the intensity of use for each of those homes that would engage in homestays to one room, then that intensity of use would be considerably less. And we may not need to think about a concentration limitation. Again, most of that would be complaint-driven. But I would think that that might be a safe place to start, and that would take the perhaps the need for a concentration limitation out of the equation or out of the mix, simply by limiting the potential intensity of use. So I'm kind of torn right now. I'm here in the council. Supporting what's being promoted tonight and presented tonight, for a number of reasons, I'm not quite ready to go there. I am suggesting that the council consider a compromise and scaling back the intensity of use. If it turns out at some point that we move forward and there are no problems and no complaints in the future, maybe we revisit it and look at perhaps increasing the intensity of use. But I would think right now that would be a compromise that might serve us better for all of the reasons that I've stated. So that's what I'm going to support tonight. I'm going to support moving forward with the homestay, but not the two-room homestay. The one-room homestay, and if they want more than that, then let's look at perhaps the category of B&B. So that's what I would support tonight. I won't support the two-room homestay, and I'm okay with the pretty much the vacation rental issue as it's presented. So those are my comments.
Mr. Mayor, if I might, I forgot one issue, if you give me a little latitude, and then sure. Also to comment on your comments as well. It's my understanding that the person that came before the Planning Commission was here earlier tonight and has left. He has a vacation rental and was charged the CUP price for going through this process. And I, as an issue of fairness, I think it's unreasonable, given where we were at in the regulatory scheme, to have him bear that cost. Now, he was a very generous individual when I talked to him. He was very kind. He wasn't upset about it as much as I was. It seemed fairly arbitrary that they were charging that amount when we didn't even have the regulatory scheme set up. So I'm specifically requesting that he get reimbursed at least the portion difference between the minor use permit and the CUP price that he paid. That's my first comment. In regards to the mayor's comments, I guess all I really want to say is we're all talking about fears and possible problems, and yet when we've all really thought about it in terms of a factual determination, there's nothing to determine quite yet what the problems are versus what they are possibly going to be. So from that perspective, what I would be willing to do is stick with the two rooms, but do a look-back provision where we visit it in a year and say, is it working or is it not working, and go that way. Because I don't really have any problem with the two rooms. I think the one person got up.
For a different process as far as the permit and the fees. It's not a minor use permit. It's probably a conditional use permit.
That's correct. So the B&B is a conditional use permit. It's more expensive, and it requires a public hearing before the Planning Commission. And it requires notification of that public hearing as well to properties within 300 feet of the applicant's property.
And then what's the price difference on that, Teresa?
Currently, the CUP price is about $3,600 versus it'll be $420 July 1st.
Okay. And then there's nothing in the ordinance right now with, I sort of asked this earlier, a maximum of cars and parking in the driveway. There's nothing, we didn't note anything on those two items.
That's correct.
Okay. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, just one question for staff and sort of the reverse question, and this is if we went with two beds and felt later on that it was a problem, whether it was through a look-back provision or complaint-driven or however, would people who already had two bedrooms, would we be able to reverse that decision relatively simply?
Well, we would modify the ordinance, if that's so directed, in a year or whenever we choose to craft the look-back provision, and that ordinance would, of course, have a first and second reading and a time period before it takes effect, and then those permits would be in non-compliance, and we would probably address it at their next business license.
Compared to dealing with a noise complaint type process, it would be a relatively simple process compared to each. Okay. The other question I had was for the mayor and how you see the relating to vacation rentals, which potentially are, I think we heard, five bedrooms, how you see the parking situation playing out there. We're actually in a relatively large situation, far more likely to have the boat situation you're describing. How you see how you see us applying this kind of logic to the vacation rentals, which we're frankly leaving wide open.
Well, that's a good question, and I think even though I'm okay with the vacation rentals, I think there needs to be some mechanism in place to perhaps better monitor the neighborhood impact of vacation rentals as relates to traffic and parking, primarily parking, for all of the reasons that I've indicated. There are high-impact vehicles with, quote, vacation rentals. They're on vacation. So they're going to bring a bunch of fun toys. I know because I own some of those. And so I think we need to be more vigilant and perhaps more involved in those kinds of issues. So
I guess I just my comment will be I'm still prepared to support the two bedrooms as proposed by staff. If at some point it becomes an issue, yes, we can look back at it. As I'm trying to note, I'm really far more concerned about the impact of a vacation rental with far more bedrooms and far more people potentially involved and their impacts on the neighborhood. But I'm prepared to go forward with it as it is, with the concentration rental, because I think that's the one thing that, while it doesn't help the specific deal, if you had two or three of these in a row, which I think could happen in some neighborhoods, if you had two or three vacation rentals in a row, they would take over the entire street. So I think that's where the concentration limit for vacation rentals specifically, but I'll go with the council if they feel it's necessary for homestays as well, is my concern. Even two of them right next door to each other could, if they were three or four bedrooms, could wipe out an entire block, on every weekend. So. That's why I think the concentration limit, however we do it. I think staff likes radius because it's simple. I'm not sure just because it happens to be 300 feet that we use for noticing that's necessarily the number, but I do think we want some sort of a concentration level, and maybe that's the place to start. And if that doesn't seem to function well, we can change it later.
Any other comments?
I will agree to the one-year look back. And let's keep it at the two, and we can do the look back for concentration level as well as for the adequacy of two. I'll support that tonight.
Okay. Then who would like to try a motion?
I'll try motions. Mr. Mayor, I would move an ordinance of the City Council of Arroyo Grande amending Title 16 of Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding vacation rentals and homestays to include the following amendment. That there would be a 300-foot linear.
Okay, on how the 300-foot linear works. So is it 300 feet going each way down the street? It includes the homes on the opposite side of the street. I understand how the circle works. I'm just not quite sure how the linear works. So if we could clarify that.
So it's a 300-foot radius drawn from the edge of the property boundary, and whatever properties it touches would be affected by the prohibition.
So when he says linear, that really is the same as radius? Is that your intent?
That wasn't my understanding. In my understanding, that linear meant in either direction.
On the street
on
face?
On the same street.
Okay, well.
That's the way it was described in the staff report.
That includes the other side of the street?
That's my understanding. If I'm wrong, let me know.
And other jurisdictions will have a linear distance on a block face, and some have a linear distance in the form of a radius. So it would affect properties behind, for example. 300 feet is a radius that would essentially on a small block neighborhood affect a block. More or less.
But it would affect the neighbor.
If it was drawn on a radius level.
But what about the neighbor on the opposite street that's backs up against them? It would affect them as well?
It would, because the 300-foot would cross the street and hit the property.
No, my motion is 300 feet on the same street.
But on both sides of that street.
Yeah, I'm fine on both sides of that street. I'm just trying to protect that particular neighborhood. if someone wants to do one street over, wants to do, I don't want to preclude that from happening, because that's a different dynamic. So my motion means is specifically on the particular street, and as Joe said, both sides of the street.
What about the second?
I will maintain the second with the provision that I said we do a look back on this a year in, and that will include a look back on
Okay. The second holds on that motion clarification, but we're still in discussion. Let me ask some questions about the motion maker and the second. How do you envision this look back? And the reason why I'm asking that, rather than a look back, would you be open to, since this is new to us, would you be open to us having a increased awareness right now from the beginning when this goes into effect, be it code enforcement, be it complaints that the PD gets, whatever the case may be, if that complaint or that disturbance emanates from one of these locations, I would like to know if we start getting a concentration of them. Rather than looking back, I would much rather have some form of a vigilance and a maintenance and an update periodically.
Well, and if you heard my motion, I said unless it dictates that it be done sooner. And what I meant by that is that one complaint, in my view, is not enough. But in your discussion of concentration, yeah, if we have a concentration, that was, if you heard my motion, I said sooner if need be, based on if something were to occur, come up. And that's.
So I'm gathering you're okay with that?
Yes.
Okay.
That was my motion.
All right. Any other discussion?
I have a question regarding what the mayor just asked about having some information delivered to us when there's complaints or there's a proliferation of these in a neighborhood. So would that be something that we could have in our items of interest that you put together, Steve?
Yeah, or a separate document. I was thinking about the mayor's suggestion if you wanted to look at something other than a one-year look back, because sometimes the one-year look back results in bringing something up when there isn't any problems going on. So if you wanted to focus just on when problems going on, we could provide a monthly report to each of the council members and then leave it up to the council if you feel it's reached a point, and you could request that a hearing be set to discuss the issue at that point.
The only reason why I'm bringing it up is rather than wait for a one-year look back, I would want to be able to check in with you, Steve, or with somebody or with the chief and say, how are we doing with the Airbnbs and the vacation rentals in terms of frequency of complaints, and have somebody be able to answer. That's all I'm asking. So whatever that requires in terms of monitoring.
I agree, because I'm interested to know how it's going to go, if we're going to have a million of these people come in, if there's going to be problems, rather than, I mean, I know Steve keeps us updated, but I'd like something that, oh, yeah, here's how it's going in front of me, I think, an email or something, whether it's on the.
Okay, anything else? All right, if there's no other discussion, we have a motion and a second and a clarification on the way the new language reads. So roll call, please.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnage?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
With the additional clarification on the oversight and the maintenance, I'll vote yes.
Mr. Mayor, I'll ask to be excused at this point. I'll ask to be excused at this point. See you all later. Be well.
Okay, moving on to our second public hearing, 9B. This is a consideration of a request from South County Sanitary for integrated solid waste collection rate increase.
members of council. I'm Debbie Malico, the Administrative Services Director. The review tonight was prepared for you by Bill Statler, so I will just hand it off to him for our presentation.
Good evening, Mayor, members of the council. The purpose of this report and my presentation is to briefly outline the rate increase that's in front of you. And the request is actually submitted by South County Sanitary Service and reviews really from four agencies, including the city of Arroyo Grande. There's a lot of advantages in reviewing this jointly. All of the South County cities provide similar service, in fact, really the exact same services. Similar franchise agreements, similar rate review methodologies that have been approved in those agreements, and the financial information is closely related. So it's a lot of economies of scale in looking at both of those. So here's the short story on the findings. South County Sanitary Service has provided all of the supporting documentation that is required for an interim year rate increase under the city's franchise agreement with them. And as a result, my recommendation is that you approve their application for a 2.05% rate increase. Should point out that that's really part of the cost of living trigger option, because the 2.05% rate that they are asking for is actually less than the rate methodology would allow them to have, which would be 2.78%. This is because in your franchise agreement you have a provision that says if any request results in a cumulative increase in the CPI greater than from the starting date, the city has the option of terminating the agreement within 9 months thereafter. This doesn't directly limit the rate increase. South County Sanitary Service could be asking for a 2.78% rate increase, and that's what they would be allowed under the agreement. But subjecting the franchise agreement to possible termination if they exceed that 2.05% threshold provides a pretty strong incentive for them not to ask for more. The cost of cost of living increase threshold to avoid triggering that potential is 2.05%, and this is the amount of the requested increase. Basis for review, in your franchise agreement, you have adopted the City of San Luis Obispo rate setting manual. You've actually had that in place since 1999, this is the basis for reviewing and analyzing the rate increase. Really briefly, the cost recovery methodology is a target for an 8% operating profit ratio on what are called allowable costs. And for the most part, that's their direct cost of operations and maintenance. They are allowed cost recovery but no profit on pass-through costs, and those are primarily tipping fees at the landfill and the green waste and franchise fees. And no recovery is allowed at all on what are considered excluded costs. That's charitable and political contributions, entertainment, income taxes, and there are limits on officer compensation. For example, when you look at their most recent audit, about $300,000 of their costs are excluded because those officer compensation exceed the amount that they're allowed under the franchise agreement. So that's the basic methodology. It has a three-year cycle. The base year review is the first year of the cycle. That includes a very comprehensive, detailed analysis of expenses and revenues and operating data, and the last base year review was completed in December 2012. In the interim years, the second and third years, they're eligible for an interim year rate increase, which really addresses two factors. For their controllable costs, they're allowed increases in the Consumer Price Index. For their pass-through costs, those they are allowed to pass through because South County Sanitary Service is not direct, and that they've correctly calculated that cumulative CPI trigger and make sure that's been correctly done. So here's just a really brief summary of where that 2.78% comes from. The Consumer Price Index change was 2%. The costs that are controllable in part of this are about 82% of their total costs, so we weight that by the 80%. They would be eligible for a 1.6% increase based on the CPI adjustment factor. Their tipping fees are projected to go up by a little less than 5%. That's about 18% of their costs. So we weigh that. That's about a little less than 1%. add those together, that's 2.5%, but then we need to make an adjustment for franchise fees. To the degree their revenues are going to be more, they're going to have to pay franchise fees on that, so we need to adjust for that, and that's really directly from the rate-setting manual and the franchise agreement, eligible for a 2.78% increase. On the other hand, that cumulative CPI trigger is 8.7%. Past increases that have been subject to the trigger, 6.65%. So that leaves them two, a little more than 2% that's available under the to avoid the trigger for that 9-month termination option. And this is the basis of the 2%. So future considerations. There is no provision for retroactivity, so it's important to act on rate applications in a timely way. And so in looking about that and looking at how we can structure a process that's more likely to result in a adequate review and hearings on their rate application. Given that we have a 45-day notice requirement, to provide time for review, my recommendation is that South County Sanitary Service submit their rate application in August. You don't control that. So regardless of when they submit their rate application, my recommendation is that we consistently use June-to-June CPI changes for both the annual change as well as the cumulative calculations. So that doesn't change from season to season, that we're always June-to-June, regardless of when their rate application comes forward. And I think I'll cancel the Security Center update. So that's my recommendation for more consistently for the future. So in conclusion, South Canada Sanitary Service is eligible for an interim rate increase of 2.78%. They've requested a lower increase of 2.05%, and that avoids that trigger option for an early franchise agreement termination. So that leaves us in terms of rate increases here in Arroyo Grande. For the 32-gallon size, that's a 33-cent-a-month increase. Most of your customers are in that 32-gallon size. For a 64-gallon, it's a 42-cent increase, and for 96 gallons, it's 52 cents. So relatively speaking, pretty modest rate increases under this methodology and in avoiding the trigger. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Questions for Bill? Go ahead.
I have a question about, I think you talked about pass-through cost, and my question is, regarding the green waste that we haul down to Santa Maria and dump down there, for lack of a better phrase, how much of that is the cost increase built into the cost increase? And if we were to do it, compared to if we were to do it here in the county?
Yeah, it's a factor. Tom Martin is probably in a better position to answer that for the most recent operations. But I want to point out that in their application, they have adjusted for that. Because the rate increase is actually something like 6% plus, but not all of their tipping fees are based on the Coal Canyon landfill. Some of those are based on green waste, and they've adjusted for that in their application. But exactly at this point, what those rates are and what percentage that is of the total, Tom is probably in a better position to answer that than I am.
Tom Martin, South County Sanitary Service. To answer your question, currently, you pay $30 a ton to get rid of the green waste at Engel and Gray, where they turn it into compost. And we don't have any place in the county that we can get it done for $30 a ton. We're talking to Bill Worrell about leasing the property next to our yard and trying something. Well, but at the present time, that's the only spot we got.
That's why I bring it up. If we were to do that, any idea what the cost would be? I hate to put you on a limb, but just some sense of.
No, it's fair. To be honest with you, Engel and Gray does it open windrow composting on bare ground on rented property from the city of Santa Maria next to their water treatment plant. For us to do it next to the property in San Luis Obispo, you're talking about building a building and doing it inside a structure. My sense is it's going to be more than $30 a ton.
So it's still cheaper to take it down there?
It is. And we're actually waiting for them to come back with a food waste component so we can add it to the residential side of the green waste thing. So even with that, I don't hold out hope that it will be cheaper if we do it here. The permitting process in San Luis County alone will take 2 years, and I can't
see if the assumptions, in that case it was particularly related to the assumption about how many people would change what size can they use. Do you ever go back and review that and see if, in fact, your assumptions were correct?
Well, there's several ways to do that. One is absolutely have confirmed in the past that the rate increase that they were asking for at the landfill was granted. We know that on May 13th, the county approved this. It's one of the reasons that this has been held up beyond what, you know, normally you would see, because all of the cities involved wanted to make sure the county was actually going to approve this particular landfill rate increase before they made a recommendation to you. So in terms of the landfill applications, we've always made sure that the triggering the landfill rates, that those have been in place. We did a detailed review about a year and a half ago now under the base year review, and that did involve, for example, taking a very close look at their audited financial statements, at their cost of operations, and basically concluded a year and a half ago so now that the rate increase that they were asking for in their base year review was reasonable given the rate setting methodology. And just happened to have done this, basically that 92% operating margin. We took a look based on their 2012 financial statements, and they actually were less recovery than that. They were about 93.6%. So under the rate methodology, that isn't necessarily something we would do, but the reality is based on their actual audited results for 2012, they were not recovering as much as the rate setting methodology would allow them to. But that's not something you have an obligation to correct for now, because this is the methodology in the interim years. There's one more interim year if they chose to submit an application for that, and then we'll be back to that base year review. So we know that they are under-recovering slightly right now. And my guess is 2013, because the rate increase they asked for to be in place in 2013 happened late, they will probably have even a lower cost recovery than they experienced in 2012. But again, in the interim years, that's really not your issue, whether they're making that recovery. That becomes something you need to consider when you do the base year review.
Say, for instance, it was the other way around. So let's say, I mean, the assumptions, one of the assumptions we were dealing with was that X many people would move down a trash can size, and therefore revenues would all go down based on a rate increase in that case. So if in fact, they didn't ask for a rate increase, would there ever be a review that says, you know, they're not at the 92%, that they're at 97% or something? Is or maybe it goes the other way, I don't know. But is there ever some sort of a review that actually looks at it from the other standpoint, or do they just not ask for an increase?
Yeah, all I can say is that 8% operating ratio only comes into place in terms of adjusting their rates when we do a base year review. If they don't recover that 8% in that two-year period of time, then they don't. You're not under any obligation, nor is there any methodology for them to recover that, because we're always kind of forward-looking in the methodology.
And I understand that when it's that way around. I'm just thinking of when it's the other way around, that in fact, you know, revenues were higher because nobody...
On the other hand, if they were to implement efficiencies in that intermere period that got them better than the 8%, then that would be something they get to hold on to, but that is not an advantage they're going to get for more than 2 years, because we're going to take a look at the base year review in the third year. So those two interim years, they're kind of on their own in terms of making that work for them, for good or bad. But if they do implement economies of scale that get them a better than 8% operating ratio for those two interim years, you will still be the beneficiary of that when we do the base year review, because those lower cost base will now be the basis for resetting that 8% target.
Going forward, it would be.
Going forward.
2 years would be lost, just like it's lost to them. And the last question I had is in the years you've done this, I've heard this three or four times now, have you ever had one of these where you did not find that the rate increase they were requesting was justified, or is it basically known up front?
The answer is no, and here's why. I think the reason why. And I actually have to be honest, I think there was 1 year where there was a slight difference in the CPI calculation, and we set it downward by just a little bit, because the process is designed to be transparent. The process is designed to be very clear about what the assumptions are. And they know what those assumptions are in the methodology. So the likelihood that it would require them to make an error somehow or another in preparing their rate application, which is an Excel spreadsheet, it's kind of designed not to have the potential for a lot of errors in it. because they know what the methodology is, and they prepare their application in accordance with that methodology, the likelihood that there's likely to be some significant difference is small. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen, but because the process is transparent, both for the person reviewing the rate application, transparent for the person preparing the rate application, it really narrows the chances that it's going to be prepared on the methodology. I'm not saying there isn't potential for error. There certainly is. But it's easily reviewable because the indexes that turned out to support a 2.78% increase and the indexes that supported 2.05 without doing the trigger, you know, are very clear. They're based on published information. So that neither the city, quite frankly, or Tom has any control over.
And on the pass-through costs, specifically the tipping fees, what factors would, first of all, who does that? Who would actually raise the tipping fees at Cold Canyon, let's say?
In this case, the County Board of Supervisors. They approved a 9-year rate strategy in funding the landfill expansion. And the good news is we're going to have very stable, knowable landfill costs for the next 8 years. On the other hand, we also know they're going to go up modestly. They're going to go up by $2.25 a ton every year for the next 8 years. And that is going to have a declining component. And this year's rate increase, you might have noticed, it's less than 1% of the total rate increase. But over time, that's going to become a diminishing percentage of the total. It's never going to count for more than 1% of whatever their total rates are. And so I think it's in the city's and the South County's best interest that kind of what landfill fees are. It's going to be very stable, very knowable for the next 8 years.
I apologize if you mentioned it already, but there was something in the material that we got with regard to the Board of Supervisors in terms of them scrutinizing the whole tipping fee issue. What were they scrutinizing specifically, and what was the outcome?
Yeah, to be frank, it was never really an issue over the costs and how that turned out in terms of the rates. The county auditor controller did this analysis, and they were very satisfied that the $2.25 a year increase was a reasonable cost, reasonable fee in funding the expansion. Tom can perhaps go into this in more detail. There were some differences of opinion as to whether the county had a role in regulating those landfill. And so that was a discussion between Waste Connections attorneys, between the county council, and ultimately they were able to come to an agreement that the county does have a role in setting those rates. And at least for the next 8 to 9 years, that issue is going to be off the table because Waste Connections agreed to the language that was ultimately adopted by the Board of Supervisors. So that notion that the Board of Supervisors has a role in setting those landfill rates, you know, I think that's been pretty much reaffirmed through this last review. Should point out, this is the first time that's ever been an issue. I mean, the County Board of Supervisors has set the landfill rates at Cold Canyon for a very long time, since I've actually been doing work in the county, which is 25 years. So very long time that the county has had that role. Surface is an issue this particular rate review cycle. Ultimately, it was resolved, and both parties came to agreement that the county would regulate the rates for the next 8 years.
So is that something that's, say, in the county tickler file that they do it routinely, or is this prompted by some application or some request from Waste Connections?
You know, since it was Waste Connections that raised the concern, I'll maybe let Tom respond to this question.
Yeah, after we went through the trials and tribulations of the 8-year EIR to expand the landfill and had the 118 conditions that the Planning Commission put upon us and the cost that went along with those, we applied to the county auditor and said, look, this is what our costs are going to be. We need you to set the rate so that we can recover these costs that you've mandated. And the auditor, with that agreement, the auditor and I came to an agreement on the number in October. The lawyers have been arguing since October about the language of what the contract was going to say. But essentially what it is that the auditor has the right to look at that annually at Cold Canyon, and if Cold Canyon is over-earning based on either the tonnage coming in or whatever mix of material comes in, then he has the right to lower that without going to the Board of Supervisors. If we request more because it isn't it isn't earning what it should have or what we projected that it should have, we have to go back to the board for their approval. So the auditor can lower it if he wants to, but if we request an increase, then it has to go in front of the board again.
And in this particular situation, you requested the
increase? We requested the $2.25 per ton per year for the next 9 years, because at the request of the City of Morro Bay and the City of San Luis Obispo, they did not want it to be as in years past. I don't know if you remember, 10 years back, the landfill rate went from $12 a ton to $18 a ton. And that was a big hit all in one piece that they didn't want to take. So their suggestion was figure out what it takes in equal installments over an 8 or 9 year period and do that so that we can minimize the impact of the ratepayers on an annual basis and nobody has to take
That when Waste Connections submits a rate application to the county for the Coal Canyon landfill, that's a separate and distinct independent analysis from what we are doing here. They're not looking at the profit ratios of South County Sanitary Service or San Luis Garbage or the other things. They're just looking at the cost of the landfill operation. And they do significant due diligence in the county auditor's controller's office. And as regards this particular rate increase, I can assure you there were not issues from the county staff perspective regarding the analytics or the numbers. It was really more of a legal issue between Waste Connections attorneys and the county council regarding regulation of the rates. But the auditor controller's office, long-standing for very many months, that they were, that they viewed favorably or felt that the rate increase was reasonable. So I think, and that's why this was so critical for so many of the agencies, is whether the county would continue to have that independent role. Because without that independent review, it would be a little more uncomfortable being able to tell you that this is a pass-through cost if they, in fact, directly controlled what that rate is. Because the county independently reviews that, and that was really the issue why none of the cities came forward with this rate analysis, because we wanted to have someone like the county perform an independent review of the cost of operating the landfill and a reasonable rate of return on that. And that's really why this is before you in May and not before you back in November or December, because really no one wanted to come forward without that independent review of those landfill costs.
Okay, my last question is, if the signatories to the franchise agreement had a desire or kind of a notion to sort of unwrap or modify the franchise agreement, what would be the process in doing that? Would it be treated the same as a termination?
I think in this case I really need to defer to your city attorney, but you have a 15-year franchise agreement effective in 2008. I think there would need to be some presenting reason as to why you wanted to modify or change your franchise agreement, and that would probably require agreement of Waste Connections to do that. But I think that's a question I have to defer to your city attorney. But you have a 15-year agreement with them, and you're six years into that agreement.
So essentially, not reading all the clauses in that agreement, Tim, are we locked in pretty much for that period of time?
Assuming they stay within their cost of living parameters, yes.
So if they don't hit any of those triggers that would terminate it, then the other provisions stay in place for the life of the agreement.
That's correct. They would have to voluntarily renegotiate.
Okay.
We'll entertain any suggestion you have. I can't tell you what Waste Connections will say, but we'll certainly be willing to sit down and talk about anything you want to talk about.
Okay. Any other questions? All right, this is a public hearing, and if there are people in the audience who would like to come forward and comment on 9B, this would be your opportunity. Anyone? Okay, seeing no one, we will close the public hearing portion of 9B, and we will bring it to the council, and we'll start with our Integrated Waste Management representative, Councilmember Brown.
Yes, it is. I'm ready to move forward. I don't know. I have really it's concerning when we go through this whole process, and you know, you say it's transparent, and we have to go through this process of you proving that it's a reasonable cost when it's supposedly transparent. It just seems like somewhat of a, I don't know what the word is. It's frustrating. But we're in the middle of the agreement, like Tim said, and so I'm ready to move forward, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, thanks. Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm ready to move forward. I think it's a reasonable increase. I think it's very, very slight, and I'm satisfied with the information from staff. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
I'll just add here that for the public that I think that one of the real protections in this is the CPI controller here, that there's really, I think, concern for me is there's no particular incentive for the operator to operate efficiently if we're just going to, you know, have a guaranteed profit. So I do think that the CPI is what works for us here. So yeah, I'm prepared to support it. I think it's, you know,
it's us. We put these provisions in there, and therefore we have no choice now but to honor them. I will say this: if I'm still in a position that at the end of this franchise agreement, I'm going to want to take another look at it. There's still things that trouble me about this, and I understand a lot of the bureaucratic noise that happens between organizations where there's a stockholder, a primary stockholder, but there are just facets of this that are troublesome for me with regard to Waste Connections and South County Sanitary. And so I'm not sure at this point what we can do. I'm going to spend, I think, some additional time maybe checking in with some folks at the county and finding out a little bit more about where they're coming from and what that relationship is. But as essentially we're pretty much locked in. The last thing I want to do is trigger more work for the attorneys, because I'm very certain at this point that that would be a pass-through cost. So, but at you know, in terms of the transparency term, yeah, we only got a few letters of protest. But I think it's important that we pay attention to what those few letters said. And the reason why is because I suspect that there's probably a whole lot of others out there who didn't take the time to write that feel the same way. They probably didn't take the time to write because they felt it wouldn't do any good. But in terms of the routine rate increases that we see, I think all the public sees here is the frequency of user fees going up for rubbish collection, for trash collection, much more so than any other category of user fee we have. This goes up more frequently than any other fee that I see that our public has to endure. And it doesn't look like that process is going to change for the next several years. So I'm not happy with it, and I'm not happy with the provisions that are in that franchise agreement. And so I'm hoping that at some point we can take another look at it. For now, I'm not seeing many options that we have in front of us, but to move forward with it. So I'll entertain a motion.
Move a resolution of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande establish integrated solid waste collection rates.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Okay, we're going to move on to the next item. Item 10 is continued business. We have none. New business. 11A, consideration of repeal of Chapter 9.29 of the Roy Grande Municipal Code. This is relating to the proximity restrictions to children's facilities for registered sex offenders. Tim, you're going to do this one?
I got lucky with this one. In June of 2010, the council adopted an ordinance entitled Proximity Restrictions to Children's Facilities for Registered Sex Offenders. It prohibited registered sex offenders from being within 300 feet of certain children's facilities, primarily schools, parks, and daycare centers. Recently, there's been appellate court cases that have held that the state legislature's comprehensive statutory scheme regarding the lives, regulating the lives of sex offenders indicates an intent to occupy the field entirely and that local laws were therefore preempted by state law. The California Supreme Court declined to hear either of those cases, so that is the state of the law at this point in time. Since the Supreme Court has determined that they won't review those cases, we've received a series of letters demanding that we repeal that ordinance and threatening lawsuits if we don't. And there have been several other cities and counties that have been sued for failing to repeal the ordinance. So in order to avoid potential restrictions...
The distance restrictions are less...
They're much more liberal. They're 1,000 feet instead of 300 feet.
They have to stay 1,000 feet away versus 300 feet away?
Right.
No, that's more conservative. I mean, that's more protective than what we had. You must have...
You're right. I know there are distance restrictions. Perhaps Chief Anaboli can come in here if he happens to be available. If not, I can get you that information between now and the next council meeting.
I'd like to know exactly what we're walking into because... Yeah, it's fine to hear you say that we have these legal problems, but I'd like to be able to tell the public, since we're repealing this, what the new standard is supposed to be.
And that probably should have been in your packet, but we'll get that for the next meeting. I can just tell you that our restrictions are inconsistent with the state's restrictions, and as a result, we don't have much choice except to take them off our books at this point in time. It's not the actual distance itself. It's the act of codifying something inconsistent with something that's preempted by state law. The entire field is preempted by state law.
I guess my other question would be if it's preempted and it's inconsistent, it's probably not enforceable. So why do we have to worry about taking it off the books if it's truly not enforceable?
Well, in the beginning, we thought that some of these threats that were levied against the city for keeping them on our books were just hollow. But after pursuing them and seeing the other cities that have been subject to the same basic threats and that, in fact, lawsuits were filed and ultimately cost a significant amount of money, that's when we brought this thing forward. We waited as long as we thought we could wait without actually exposing us to live litigation.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Any other questions? No. Okay, not a public hearing, but if anyone would like to come forward, no? Okay. All right, we'll bring this back to the council. Start with Councilmember Barnich.
I am interested because I didn't think about the question that Tim brought up. I'm not sure if we need to wait for that information or we move forward with this and get the information later.
I think it changes the action, but we'll get that out in a memo form to you
okay.
in the next couple of days.
Okay. I don't really see us doing anything but moving forward. I don't want to go through a bunch of legal fees if it doesn't look like we're going to win. I wish we could keep the law on the books, but from past practice with other cities, it doesn't look like we can. So I'm reluctantly ready to move forward.
Okay, thanks. Councilmember Brown?
I agree.
Mayor Pro Tem?
Yeah, I also agree.
Since I think the letters were threatening lawsuits were addressed to me, I would agree as well. It's another wonderful move on the part of the state of California. I'll support the recommendation as well. Entertain a motion.
move approval of the City Council repealing Chapter 9.29 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code relating to proximity restrictions to children facilities for registered sex offenders.
All right, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second, but I'm going to just ask the city attorney if that's the... Do we have to read the actual ordinance?
Sorry.
Okay.
She somehow got it perfect.
All right.
I was following.
I'll second that.
Happy birthday.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Burnett?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, we're going to go to City Council reports next. I'll go first. The COG did not meet. It is going to meet the first week in June the 4th. But the RTA did meet. I was not able to attend that meeting. Councilmember Costello attended for me, but he isn't here this evening, so we'll catch up to that report the next time. The Sanitation District did meet. The plant continues to operate well within our permitted limits. The last agenda was pretty routine, and we discussed, I think, as Mayor Pro Tem mentioned, the possibility in the future of moving to one meeting a month. After some discussion, I think we ultimately decided that we would keep the current meeting schedule, but we would decide on a month-by-month basis if, in fact, two meetings were needed for that month. We also recognize that as we continue to pursue funding, the funding potential for not only redundant infrastructure at the plant, but also water recycling, that certainly the need for the frequency of meetings would return. We probably would not entertain canceling meetings, but again, we would let
act plan for in the future. Moving on to the EVC, we did have a nice report from Paso Robles on their economic development element. And this next week's actually, or tomorrow, is actually the big meeting in which really the strategy going forward for the next year, strategy and goals will be laid out for the EVC, and I'll have that report next month. And that concludes my report.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Costello, as I indicated, we'll catch up with his reports for APCD and the Five Cities Fire Authority. Just a note on that, I'll be attending that meeting again for Joe. That's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks, I think. So we'll go to Councilmember Brown.
Okay, Integrated Waste Management had a rather lively, interesting meeting and was the basis for my question to Tom about the tipping and all that in Santa Maria. Turns out that Integrated Waste is trying to find a green waste composting facility in San Luis County since they closed it down at the Cold Canyon landfill. Turns out that Waste Connections has a piece of property right next to the airport with a big building on it that would have to be increased to work, and Tom was all for it. He was ready to move forward, and the head of Waste Management came out from Texas and put a kibosh on that, saying the margins weren't high enough and they didn't want to be a part of it. So the next thing that happened was there's a piece of property right next to Waste Connections that the county has control over, and they're thinking about putting it out to bid and building an indoor facility there, and then having basically Waste Connections put a hole in their fence and drive over and take the material through their property right onto this new site if it goes through. But it still has to go to the supervisors and they still have to discuss it. But that's the one piece of property that they've been able to find in the county that would work. Bunyan Brothers tried to do something and that created a big uproar in San Luis. And I still think, I'm convinced that it still would be cheaper if they didn't have to drive it all the way to Santa Maria, despite what we heard tonight. I still have questions about that. So that was that. The RAC is still dealing with grant applications that have been sped up due to the emergency water declaration, but it's still a slow process, and we're going through the IWRM process to do that. It's a application process that is long and arduous, and currently AG doesn't have anything in the pipeline. They will, but they don't at this current round of funding. So there's nothing else to report there.
I have a question for you.
Yes?
On the IWMA.
Yes.
Did you guys at some point talk about the TARP fee at Cold Canyon?
No.
The requirement for pretty much every load that goes in there to be tarped?
It didn't come up, no.
Is that something, do you know if that came out of Sacramento or if, is that?
I'm glad to find out, but I don't know the answer.
Okay. I can understand. Maybe if you go back at your next meeting, you can check in with Bill Worrell on that.
I will.
But essentially, every truck that goes in there, public or private,
right,
has to be tarped. And it doesn't matter that you're not carrying green waste or plant material or dirt.
Right.
You could be carrying a television set.
Right.
And it still has to be tarped.
Right.
Or you pay an incredible penalty fee if it's not the situation. I'm wondering where that came from.
I'll check. I'll actually call tomorrow and find out.
All right. Okay. Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you. Zone 3 Water Advisory Board, we met, and according to the farmer representative that was there, Brian Talley, said it was the liveliest meeting we'd had in a long time. So it was on the surplus water. We recommended to the Board of Supervisors to declare 2,327 acre feet of surplus water. We all agree that surplus water is a terrible name because we know we're in a drought. It's not really surplus water. It's just water that we're all entitled to that we haven't used, that we sort of account for to be able to use and not have to tap our wells and reduce the pumping of the wells. So that you saw that in the consent agenda. The letter to the Board of Supervisors, and then the Homeless Services Homeless Services Coordinating Council did meet. That was a big meeting with a big agenda as well. As you've probably read in the paper, as of June 2nd, the Maxine Lewis Shelter and the Prado Day Center are going to be that over in San Luis Obispo County, 30,000 people have applied for insurance for Covered California, and that's 1 in 9 in San Luis Obispo County. So they thought that was a pretty remarkable statistic. That's it. Thanks. Oh, and then the tourism committee, you were not meeting till next month. Thank you.
Okay. Very good. All right. We're going to move to item 13, council communication. Let me ask the council first before I get into my two items. Any observations, recommendations, requests? Yes.
Yes, please. Regarding the letter that the Land Conservancy sent to the council asking for monetary donation, I'd like to bring that back for discussion at the June 10th council meeting, if that's the will of the council.
How about the first available opportunity? Is there a time limit on that? What's our June 10th schedule look like?
Well, my suggestion would be that it would be appropriate to discuss it during the year-end budget discussion, which is going to be on June 10th. So rather than having it a separate item, I'd strongly recommend, because we're going to be discussing the process we went through in terms of establishing priorities, what funding is available. And so I really think that would be the appropriate time to bring it up as it relates to other proposed expenditures.
That's okay. My only reservations would be, obviously, if someone's watching the meeting tonight and would like to come and comment, they're hearing that it will be on the agenda. But if it's not a separate item, then I feel like the public maybe won't be informed because it's not a separate item. So that would be my only reservation. I don't know if anyone else has that same thought.
Well, I'm thinking that realistically, if we're going to make any kind of decision on that amount of money, it's going to have to be part of a budget discussion. So I'm not sure that we can have a separate item on that.
Well, I'm not. I don't think I'm.
When we contributed money for the skate park in Grover Beach, we just did that through the consent agenda. It wasn't done through a particular budget process.
How much was that?
It doesn't matter. It didn't require a budget process.
Well, if we're going to throw this into the mix with other budget priorities, that's my concern. Is that what you're saying, Steve?
Well, I felt strongly that it should be evaluated based on our other budget
can
priorities.
Can we somehow include it in the title? Can we somehow include it in the title so that the public, you know, you don't have to read the staff report to find it, that it's in the title that says budget review and consideration of contribution to the regional preserve so the public will.
Tell you what, why don't we do this? Kristen, why don't I think we agree it should come back in terms of how it appears on the agenda. If that timing is okay, why don't you get together with Steve and come up with some kind of a way to put it on the agenda so that people know it's going to be discussed and get some folks here.
I mean, we could probably, I guess, identify it as a separate item and then just discuss them concurrently.
That's sort of what I was thinking. I mean, I know we have a lot of other things to pay for. I'm not saying that we need to give them everything they're asking for, but I want it to at least be discussed and have the public have an opportunity to come in and weigh in on it and have them note that, oh, this is coming up. So if we can do it that way, which you just suggested, is have it a separate item but then discuss it under the budget, that's fine. That's fine with me. That's okay.
Okay. Well, why don't we do that then? Why don't we list it as a separate item, have people come in, discuss their concerns or support or whatever the case may be, and as long as it's understood that the ultimate decision of the council will be forthcoming when we do the budget evaluation and look at other, you know, priorities and requirements and have it come out then. Whatever we decide to allocate.
That's great. Our new practice is to actually vote on these things so that there's no ambiguity. So if you want to put that in a motion, that would probably help us.
Okay.
You could say so moved and we'd get it.
After all that. Okay, so moved.
Second.
All right. Motion and a second. Roll call.
Councilmember Barnage?
Yes.
They want to involve the council as a whole on in filming some sort of promotional. I'm sure they're going to fill in the details, but one thing that I managed to get us out of, and that is that we don't have to do a communal chicken dance, but there is going to be some form of... There's going to be some form of levity, I would imagine, that will be forthcoming from this very dais. And when they, you know, they want to do this an hour prior to the next council meeting on June the 10th. And they are working with a deadline. So that
5 o'clock. I mean,
that would mean we have to be here at 5 o'clock. And it is going to be a... it's going to be the dress code is Tommy Bahama or something similar. So, Kristen, for you, that can be anything that looks tropical.
Okay, noted.
But they do make Tommy Bahama for women. Or your best Aloha shirt. Doesn't have to be a Tommy Bahama. So, but anyway, is that date going to work? I told Judith that I would get back and confirm with her. Is 5 o'clock okay?
Sure.
Yeah, I just need...
Okay, I think Joe's okay with that, too, I'm pretty sure. So, all right. The second issue I brought up earlier during agenda review, on the 4th I am going to be out of town. Joe is going to be who's my alternate, COG, is going to be out of town. That COG meeting is going to take place at the Board of Supervisors at 8:30. And Jim, I know you're on vacation, right? So that leaves Kristen and Tim.
What day of the week is that?
That's a Wednesday.
I'm in Chicago.
You're in Chicago.
Guess that leaves me.
So is that something you would be able to do?
Hopefully, yes. I haven't got my calendar for that week yet, but yeah.
Okay.
I'll plan on it. Let me put that back.
June the 4th, 8:30 at the Board of Supervisors.
Spend the whole day there.
No, it would be. I'm estimating you would be out before lunch.
But I have the 2 o'clock meeting with the airport.
Oh, okay.
I'm doing that for you too.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I wish there was some way I could compensate you, but
you already have, Tony. You already have.
Okay. Well, then we have to do this by vote. So I would move that schedule permitting that Councilmember Brown be named as a temporary alternate for the COG meeting, and that will give him the opportunity to vote.
I'll second that.
All right. So we have a motion and a second discussion. Roll call.
A voice vote is sufficient.
Yes.
What's
yes,
that?
Yes.
A voice vote?
Yep.
Aye.
All
aye.
Those in favor?
Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Yep. Okay. No. Okay. Item 14, staff communication. Anything, Steve?
Nothing except the staff did not get out of doing the chicken dance.
Oh, that's too bad.
We will be making the city.
Are you guys doing the next week after the staff meeting?
June 10th, I think, is our new date. And staff is very excited about it.
Okay.
I see that.
All right. Community comments and suggestions. Anything, Barbara? Okay. Then are we still going to do closed session?
Yes, and we'll make it quick.
All right. All right, then we are going to move to closed session at this time. Recognize that any report out of closed session will be given at the next regularly scheduled council meeting, which will be June the 10th. So council's adjourned to closed session at this time.